Coming up on Boston Public Radio, after 7 days of deliberation, the guilty verdicts are in the corruption trial at the probation department. There were no cameras in the courtroom, but the Herald's Peter Galzinis was. He'll describe the drama. And attorney Harry Mannion will say whether or not there'll be any more indictments or can Beacon Hill rest easy. Then Celtic Sojourn's Brian O'Donovan gives us the details on Saturday and Sunday's Summer Arts Weekend in Copley Square. All kinds of music, dance, and it's free. Brian will join us.
The president of Berklee College of Music tells us why it's not a disaster when Johnny comes home and says, "Dad, I want to be a musician." Then Emily Rooney with a world famous list and the joys of the 3-day work week. Then listen to this, a wine and donut brunch. Stay tuned for all the scrumptious details on that. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Obama will host the leaders of 3 Central American countries at the White House within hours to talk about ways to stem the growing immigration crisis along the southern U.S. border. NPR's Jackie Northam reports the meeting is expected to center on the mounting number of unaccompanied children from Central America who've been crossing illegally onto U.S. soil.
Presidents Juan Orlando Hernandez of Honduras, Otto Perez Molina of Guatemala, and Salvador Sanchez Seren of El Salvador have come to Washington with a unified message that the problem of unaccompanied migrant children crossing into the U.S. must be tackled from all sides. Some 52,000 unaccompanied children have been caught crossing the southern U.S. border since last fall. The Central American leaders say among the chief causes are poverty, drugs, and violence. The U.S. has been pushing the Central American nations to do more to inform their public that just because the kids cross the border doesn't guarantee they can stay. The Obama administration has asked Congress for a $3.7 billion aid package to expand border security and streamline the immigration process. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli and Hamas leaders reportedly are considering a proposed ceasefire, although their conditions still appear far apart. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is calling for a humanitarian corridor to be set up to evacuate people wounded in Gaza. Here's NPR's Emily Harris.
The World Health Organization says 4 hospitals have been damaged in the Gaza Strip so far, more than 2 weeks since Israel's air campaign started and a week after ground fighting began. Friday, Palestinian health officials say a children's hospital in Gaza City was damaged when an Israeli airstrike hit a nearby building. One child in the hospital was reported killed. Israel is floating the idea its troops would stay on the ground in Gaza, even after a ceasefire, to continue to destroy more tunnels used by militant fighters. Hamas has said its aim in ceasefire discussions is to end the tight restrictions on trade and travel that over time have devastated the economy in the Gaza Strip. Emily Harris, NPR News, Gaza.
An Air Canada flight was forced to circle Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport for about 10 minutes today while air traffic control determined when it would be safe to land. It's one example of security worries during a week of multiple aviation disasters around the world. They prompted additional precautionary measures in Israel due to the current conflict with Hamas. For 2 days, international airlines avoided flying into Tel Aviv after a Hamas rocket landed near the airport. The French military has possession of one of the flight recorders from the Algerian plane that crashed in northern Mali yesterday. Authorities say it's likely bad weather caused the Air Algeria flight to go down with 116 people on board. Nearly half of the passengers were French. At last check on Wall Street, Dow was down 137 points at 16,947. This is NPR News.
And from the WGBH Radio Newsroom in Boston, I'm Jordan Weinstein. Thousands of Market Basket grocery chain workers and supporters are rallying again today in Tewkesbury as they press their demand that former CEO Arthur T. Demolis be reinstated. A Market Basket employee tells NECN that protesters are afraid the new co-CEOs will sell off the chain.
We're going to lose a lot of our benefits. Prices will go up in the stores, and people are going to, it's going to hurt. And it's not going to hurt just the employees. It's going to hurt our customers, the faithful customers that have been shopping with Market Basket since day one.
The company's board of directors is meeting today in Boston and could take up Demoulas' proposal to buy up the rest of the company that his side of the family doesn't own. More than 20 antitrust experts and health economists have asked a judge to block efforts by Partners Healthcare System to absorb 3 more hospitals. The petition says the Partners case is a high-profile test of regulators' ability to promote competition in a market dominated by a powerful hospital and provider network. A Newton school superintendent has been docked a week's pay after failing to credit Governor Deval Patrick for parts of his speeches at the city's two public high schools. A student newspaper this week noted the remarks from David Fleischman were similar to a speech Patrick made in May to Boston University graduates. A judge has rejected a motion by Aaron Hernandez's lawyers to dismiss charges in last year's slaying of Odin Lloyd near the former Patriot star's home. Hernandez is slated to face trial in Lloyd's killing in January and also has been charged with killing two men in Boston in 2012. The Red Sox face the Rays tonight in Tampa Bay. Support for NPR comes from Wix.com, giving business owners the ability to create their own website with the drag-and-drop builder. Learn more at Wix.com. This is WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Hey, it's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hi, Jim.
You know, before we get to the probation trial, which we're going to do right up front, all of you know that thousands and thousands, maybe more than 10,000 people rallied in Tewksbury this morning in support of the Market Basket workers and the return of Arthur T. Demoulas to the CEO-ship, for lack of a better expression. Simultaneously, the board of directors is meeting theoretically to entertain a variety of things, including the offer of Arthur T. to rebuy, to buy back the company. They're meeting at the law firm Robeson Gray at the Prudential Center. If anything comes out of that meeting today publicly, we'll either report it here before 2 o'clock or you'll hear it on WGBH News. But to the other huge story, if not the biggest story of them all, was high drama yesterday, as you know, in courtroom 18 of the John J. Moakley Federal Courthouse. There was crying, sobbing, yelling, and even fainting as the verdict of the probation corruption trial was being delivered. And since there aren't cameras in federal courtrooms, we've got the next best thing. That would be Boston Herald columnist Peter Galzinis, who's been covering this trial. Peter, good to see your column this morning. It was fabulous, by the way.
Thank you. It was fabulous, and it's wrenching because you show what the impact on the family members. Give us the picture because we weren't there, no cameras. Tell us what you saw beginning. We knew the verdict was in. You're sitting in the courtroom. The verdict had yet to be announced. It began there. What did you see the family members doing?
Well, let's back up a little bit before that. I got a call. You know, you're in this state of suspended animation where you're waiting. You're waiting for several days. And so the barriers kind of melt away between media and people and, you know, with,
Media and the defendants
who find themselves in this situation. And, you know, you can see the pressure on their face, and particularly as the hours wear on. But, you know, you bump into them, you're schmoozing with them a little bit. And that's what I was doing with Burke, with William Burke, one of the three defendants. And his lawyer, John Amabile, called me and said, there's a verdict. We were outside on Fan Pier. The courthouse is on Fan Pier.
Beautiful,
so
beautiful spot.
It's a beautiful
right
spot.
Boston Harbor.
Right at the edge of the harbor. And I turned around to him and I said, there's a verdict.
So wait a second. You told the one of the three defendants
there
was a verdict before he knew independently?
Before he knew. That's right.
And what was his reaction?
His face just, you know, he turned stone face and very serious. And, you know, before that he had been talking to me about growing potatoes in his home in Hatfield, and so he immediately began walking toward the rear entrance of the courthouse. I saw one of his daughters come running over because everybody started to move at that point, and she said, do they have a question? And they said, no, they've got a verdict. And her face, it was as if she had seen a car crash, and she just said, oh, my God. Everybody started up to the courthouse. We go up to the courthouse. We get in there, sit down. And for a while, there's absolutely nothing happening. The judge hasn't come in yet, and everybody is sort of getting in place. And suddenly, one of Jack O'Brien's daughters starts rocking back and forth in the front row right behind her father and begins sobbing uncontrollably. And the mother is sitting next to her.
How old's the daughter, like in her 20s?
Yeah, I would say probably mid-20s.
Okay,
and she is rocking back and forth. She's trying to muffle her cries, but they're getting louder and louder and louder. And the jury, neither the jury nor the judge has come into the room yet. And they're trying to calm her down, and then the judge comes in. And when the judge comes in and the jury walks in, the sobbing just spreads. And it just spreads throughout the immediate family there and the family members behind them. And the jury stands up, they hand the verdict slip to the clerk, and when the guilty start, they start screaming. And
being family members?
Family members. And then Laurie's wife yells out,
John O'Brien's wife,
the government is corrupt.
That I want to be clear here. I've read a lot and heard a lot that someone related to the family shouted out, the government is corrupt. That was John O'Brien's wife?
I was told by O'Brien's lawyer and another person who was there that it was his wife.
Okay, so continue.
So she shouts out, the government is corrupt. Then what happens?
Right. And they begin continue reading. You're hearing guilty, guilty, guilty. And I turn over and I look and I see his wife. Her eyes begin to close and she kind of sort of falls back and then starts to fall forward. And she, no exaggeration, is gray. Her all the color is gone and she's gray. And she begins to keel over, and all of the girls and, you know, who are next to her, the other family members who have been screaming anyway, crying anyway, start to get hysterical. They lay her down on the bench. People behind her, probably a brother-in-law or cousins, whatever, are screaming for nurses to come in, get a nurse, get medical attention. And the judge looks up and instructs the clerk to keep on reading.
While the wife is passed out.
Why is she not only passed? Well, she's sort of semi passed out. Her eyes are closed, and she's moaning.
Oh God!
On the bench, and I'm literally across. I'm on the other side of the aisle. I'm like looking right at her, and they're still reading. And they, again, this verdict slip goes on for like 7 pages.
Oh my God!
They have to go down 104 situations. And read each one.
So they're reading, and while the moaning and the screaming is going on,
right.
Where's
the
defendant?
Some of the other media members are checking off their checklist and stuff. And
where's the defendant, John O'Brien? What's he doing? Because he's right in front of them, I presume.
When the sort of cascade of guilty started, he at one point dropped his head, put his head down on the defense table, sort of in his arms, and then when he found out that his wife had passed out and was stretched out on the bench, he got up and he tried to, you know, yell to her and then give her some water. And, you know, he just, you know.
While the verdicts continued to be read?
While the verdicts continued.
You know, David Frank, the head of Mass Lawyers Weekly, wrote in his piece on this, he describes it as, never seen anything like this before in a courtroom. Had you?
No.
Why didn't the judge pause for a minute?
The
verdicts were in. What's the harm to attend to the health of the guy's wife?
I have no idea. I mean, it was surreal.
They ended up coming in and carrying her out in a stretcher.
She was there. She was on the bench, stretched out until all the verdicts had been read. And then the wheelchair was in the back. They were giving her water, putting like compresses on her head and neck. And eventually they put her in a wheelchair and then a stretcher and took her out. When I walked out to the front of the courthouse, there were fire engines out there. EMT vehicle.
An ambulance.
Can I tell you, one of the reasons, if you haven't read Peter's column,
it's in addition to Henry
said, the reason it's important is the same reason that Marjorie mentioned a minute ago. I have to say, and we're going to talk about this with you in a few minutes, Peter, I'm a lot less sympathetic to the O'Brien et al. Crowd here than you probably are. Having said that, we do never focus, even if we're angry at defendants, one never focuses on the impact of people who love these people, who are the children, the spouses, the co-workers. I mean, what a scene. I mean, it is just surreal.
And the money, O'Brien had a public defender. I'm not sure why he did, so we presume he wasn't paying for his defense.
These are the federal public defenders.
Federal public defender. But the other, Tavares, had her own private lawyer,
right,
to whom she's probably paid you know, six figures at least.
And Jeff Denner and Brad Bailey.
Jeff Denner, that's right. And she, and they're all going to lose their pensions. They're going to lose their jobs when they come out of prison, however long they spend there. They will be convicted felons, which is difficult to put on your resume.
Right.
Am I correct? Yeah.
I can answer that, and I wasn't even there. You know, Peter, don't go away. We're talking to Peter Galzinis from the Boston Herald, who was in the courtroom, of course, as we've said 3,000 times. We and you couldn't be in the courtroom because there are no cameras in federal courtrooms. That's a topic for another day. There are a huge number of legal implications, obviously, of this case. Joining us on the phone to talk through them and what the fallout could be is attorney Harry Mannion. Harry is the founding partner of Cooley, Mannion and Jones. Harry Mannion, thanks so much. Oh, I'm sorry. My apologies. I thought he was in line. He'll be there. Harry, you are there, correct?
I am, Jim. How are you?
You either are or you aren't. It appears you are.
Hi.
Harry, great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you, Marjorie. Hey, Peter. I'm actually in Chicago, but I've been following this because one of the co-defendants was defended by my moot court partner at UC Law and my close friend John Amabile. So I've been following.
John's a great guy. I love John.
He's a great lawyer. Harry,
character.
Let me ask you the legal question that concerns me. The judge over and over in this case said patronage is not a crime. The defense argument obviously was that patronage is not a crime and that this was business as usual up on Beacon Hill. Bill Weld called this patronage. The former governor, of course, called this the Mazzola oil of getting things done. So have we now criminalized patronage, or was this something beyond patronage?
We have, Marjorie. I'm really troubled by this prosecution. When I saw the verdict, I was hoping for a not guilty because I just don't think this is criminal behavior. And
Harry, we have a bad connection here. Continue and let's see if we can make this work. Go ahead.
Actually,
we're going to put Harry on hold for just a couple of seconds and see if we can get a better connection. As you heard, Harry Mannion is calling us from Chicago, and we have actually a ton of questions for him. You know, as we're speaking to Peter and Harry, if you have questions or thoughts or reflection, you just heard Harry Mannion say what I think is a minority position. I'm not sure that he was very disappointed by the verdicts in this case. Give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. If you want to weigh in on one of the highest profile corruption cases we've seen here in a long time.
Well, I'd like to weigh in first.
Sure.
And here's my take on this. This, to me, is similar in many ways to the Bulger trial, because I'm not comparing at all a patronage at the State House to a serial killer, obviously. But I feel as though, just like in the Bulger trial where the FBI, the government, escaped unscathed, once again, we have the other half of this corruption escaping unscathed.
Right.
I mean, I'm very fond of Beacon Hill, the legislators.
Yes.
I mean, Bob DeLeo seems like a wonderful guy, but he's been called an unindicted conspirator, fairly or unfairly. There's all sorts of people. We know this guy, Petrolatti, that was called the patronage king, that was a rep for a long time getting jobs for everybody. So I feel as though that the people that were carrying out the dirty work are now facing decades in jail, while the people who pushed them to carry out the dirty work to benefit themselves and their careers, they may be getting bad press, but they're not going to jail.
And on the street yesterday outside the courthouse, Ortiz, Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney, essentially dodged all those questions.
We're going to play that sound in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, she just didn't want to get into it. And she had her cue cards and focused on the convictions, but just avoided getting into any talk about DeLeo or anybody else. You
know? Okay, we're going to try Harry Mannion one more time. Harry, they have real phones in Chicago, correct?
They do. I'm actually at my father-in-law's 80th birthday. We're celebrating this weekend, so he's allowing me to use his landline.
Well, happy birthday to your father-in-law.
So, Harry,
a former judge.
Oh, maybe we'll talk to him after we talk to you.
So, Harry, you just said that they criminalized patronage, but then you could also argue, and I would argue, that they went beyond the usual patronage, where they're erasing people's scores and really creating this elaborate, phony hiring system. That wasn't just give my brother-in-law a job.
No. And that's the prosecution's argument, Marjorie. But my concern is a broader one, and that is sort of expanding the concept of racketeering and mail fraud. That, along with money laundering, is where the almost every prosecution goes these days, and it's catching and trying to capture a whole variety of conduct, And when you get away from, you know, quid pro quo bribery and, you know, and money in bras and bags of money across the table and you know, and other gratuities, no matter how the human species are able to disguise it, you get into this whole, you know, you've deprived the government of their good services. Well, that, the Supreme Court said that's not really viable anymore as a mail fraud predicate. So the thought is, look, if it were just plain patronage, as Marjorie points out, then there'd really be an argument here. But I just don't. It worries me from a, you know, a fundamental liberty perspective, and I think all spectra of the ideological spectrum can appreciate this, that when government has the tools to sort of go after any kind of conduct that does not fit sort of traditional parameters of, yeah, I knew it was wrong. If you put O'Brien under a lie detector test right now, and you said, did you think you were committing a crime when you did this, he would say no, and the needle probably wouldn't move. And once you get away from mens rea, guilty mind, into an area of, well, you know, everyone does it, and it's, this is how the system works, and maybe I did it a little better, or maybe I was on steroids. My system was on steroids. Look, if you go in and you start altering government documents and personnel files, all right, charge him with that. That's a state crime. Charge him with that. But if you're going to charge him with racketeering, this isn't racketeering, and this wasn't a conspiracy. And I really do think that the racketeering and the conspiracy to commit racketeering will both get flipped in the First Circuit. I really do. And I think there's a real good chance. I think there's a real good chance that these verdicts do not hold.
And by the way, similar sort of things were said about a rather vague law that caused Sal DeMacy to go to prison.
Yeah, so, I'm a close friend of Sal's, yeah, and know him and Debbie extremely well. But at the heart of that, though, Jim, there was the allegation of quid pro quo that he took. You know, he got $56,000 in exchange for, to his law firm, rooted through his law firm, in exchange for giving out a contract. That's classic quid pro quo. But O'Brien, you know, this is so amorphous. And as I was saying about the First Circuit, I also think Judge Young, who is a towering intellect. I mean, I tried cases when he was a superior court judge, and he's been a federal court judge for probably 20, 25 years. He's a towering intellect and is a very free thinker.
One of the things he did yesterday is basically tell the defendants they had no First Amendment rights, that they couldn't impugn the jury, and the lawyer stands up and says, excuse me, they have a First Amendment right, and Judge Young's response is, okay, test me. But, you know, let me continue with one other thing that's on everybody's mind, and we're talking to Frank Underwood. Oh, I'm sorry, we're talking to Harry Mannion.
Frank Underwood.
Now, Harry Mannion from Cooley Mannion Jones, I want you to listen to a little exchange between reporters and Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney, after her prepared statement yesterday. This is about the great unanswered question, obviously, about the Speaker of the House. Please listen.
I know where you're going.
Why is it appropriate to call him the center of a criminal enterprise and somebody who bribed his fellow state reps?
I'm going to rest on the evidence that was presented in court. There are many factors that
go
into...
Was there evidence against Robert Taleo that was presented in this course?
Are you going to let me answer the question, David?
I'm asking you. Was there evidence presented in this course beyond a reasonable doubt about Robert
Taleo? Many of you were in court. You saw what the witness testimony was under oath. You saw the exhibits that we presented. And I'm going to rely on what was presented in court, because that's where cases get tried, in this office, in a courtroom, and not here in front of the media.
Okay, so Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney, Harry Mannion, either couldn't or wouldn't answer the question. Can you answer the question as to why? Put yourself in the place of the prosecutor, not one who thinks that the defendants were inappropriately convicted. The prosecutors think that there was this quid pro quo, that there was this job rigging scheme. Half of the scheme is sitting in the courtroom as a defendant. The other half is sitting unindicted, uncalled as a witness, not even mentioned in the opening statement. What's going on there?
Why didn't the government indict DeLeo?
That's the question. Why?
Why did not they indict DeLeo? He wasn't cooperating. He's got, you know, one of the greatest lawyers in Boston, who was, you know, we know, I know very well, Bob Popeo representing
sure.
him. So, you know, that's an old trick, Jim, you know, where you don't want to actually charge him, and you don't even want to call him an unindicted co-conspirator, but then you, then in a public courtroom, you accuse him of a crime. And then, so he has no ability other than through the media and through his lawyer to defend himself. It's just, I was very taken aback. I'm a very close friend of Carmen's. I knew her late husband very well, and so I set that aside when I look at her public performance, and I just don't understand, and I don't think there is an answer for it. Why DeLeo, if you were holding evidence against him, and you apparently were, because that's what you said in the public courtroom, that it was a, you know, quid pro quo a deal that he made with O'Brien. And O'Brien, by the way, is the hub of this conspiracy, this mail fraud racketeering conspiracy. And this is, you know, this is a pretty sexy one. I want to be speaker, and I need Jobs to be speaker. Help me here, John, and I'll take care of you with some money. Now, this is starting to sound to me like something along the lines of mail fraud. And you don't bring that, and you bring in these sort of amorphous relatives and second cousins. I just don't understand it. And of course, she ducked it yesterday. But I think that the media and the legal profession, particularly the defense bar, is not going to let this rest. Now,
Harry,
might she turn around and indict him?
Well, that's my question.
It,
that's
possible.
That's my final question for you, if I can, Harry Mannion. A lot of speculation. Before the verdicts, almost everybody was saying it's over. No Beacon Hillite is going to be indicted ever here. Is it possible that post-conviction yesterday that John O'Brien says, I don't want to be apart from my family for 5, 10, 20 years, the government says to him, okay, you flip, you start testifying against these legislators, and we'll go easy on it. Is that even remotely possible, Harry Mannion?
It is possible. It's not just remotely possible. It's possible because that. I mean, he ran a department. Okay, he was a political guy. I grew up with Tommy Finneran in Dorchester, and he ran a department. But when you start talking about, you know, speakers, legislators, Senate presidents, Senate members, that's a whole different kettle of fish. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if. An assistant U.S. Attorney or Wyshak or Karen Bell reached out to, you know, you've been living together for months, mm-hmm. to one of the defendants, all three of the defendants, you know, and say, look, the time is now for you to tell us really what happened. And if you're willing to do a proffer, meaning everything off the record, tell us where you might be willing to go. And if the proffer sounds kind of tasty, we'll pursue it. And if it all turns out to be good, we'll go and see Judge Young, and we'll tell him you're cooperating. We'll be looking for a major downward departure for you, which is one of the indicia of sentencing guidelines. If you're cooperating, even post after the fact, you get a downward departure. And so it's not a fanciful thought, Jim.
Hey,
Harry Mannion, thank you very much
really
for being with us, Harry, especially calling in from Chicago at the birthday of 80th birthday.
Anytime you get.
Thank you. Harry Mannion is the founding partner of Cooley, Mannion and Jones. Let's get back to you, Peter Gessler. Before I do, though, we should say that we may be breaking some news here, according to Harry Mannion, that we could have not one speaker, not two speakers, not three speakers, but it could be. There's not the trifecta. What's if you have four in a row indicted in Massachusetts?
A disaster is what four in a row.
Four in a row. This is a long way off, of course, but he just raised the prospect that faced with 20 years in jail, of John O'Brien or one of his co-defendants could say, I am ready to cooperate here. Again, I like Bob DeLeo, but this does not look good for him. What do you think of this verdict, Peter Gelsinis? You've been covering this from beginning to end.
You know, it's like I said, if they're racketeers and the jury found them to be racketeers, then you know they're racketeers who also, you know, coach girls basketball. They're racketeers who Liz Tavares and her partner are raising a 13, 14 year old daughter. I mean, Burke is a part-time farmer in Hatfield. I mean, it's hard for me to get my, you know, somebody who grew up in Whitey's neighborhood. It's
you mean
a little
it's not like
me.
Kevin Weeks, who did 5 years in jail after participating in all these murders involving Whitey Bulger?
Yeah, like everybody else, I mean, I don't think that these three are the soul of evil in this situation. I think.
Well, you feel like Marjorie does. Would you not feel better about this verdict if the other people who had been convicted yesterday had been the other half of the quid pro quo?
And you had seen the full picture. You had seen more, you know, there would have been more attention focused on how things operated in total, as opposed to simply focusing from this side of the fence.
I mean, two observations here, if I can. One, I totally agree with one thing Harry Mannion said. I have no idea if Bob DeLeo broke the law or not, the Speaker. The fact that his name was raised late in the trial,
awful,
that he had no opportunity except in a press release and a brief, press appearance out in the hall outside his office, is
there was
it's
no
a
mention.
Disgrace to put in the opening statement. He wasn't
there was
even
no
mentioning.
Mention. It was when Ed Ryan, who is O'Brien's legislative liaison, brought it up.
And one last thing, I don't know if I'm sure people saw it was a great. Who wrote the piece in the Herald about all the lawmakers running away yesterday? Who wrote?
Oh, Erin Smith had a great piece today where she talked about going up to try to interview lawmakers and how they were scampering away, literally down the halls and skulking out the back doors of the State House to avoid commenting on this. I mean, there was comment. Hillary Chabot in the Herald did get a comment from one legislator who said something. You think I'm going to write anybody any letter of recommendation after this? Again, see where I think you and I differ a little bit in this, Peter Gelsinus. I mean, patronage, we all understand that. What I think, as I said to Harry Mannion, when it goes beyond changing the scores and having a person that's recommended by three all their bosses, this is the person for the job, and that person gets scuttled because it means money for their family, it means money for their pension. It's serious business. I think they went on beyond patronage.
All right. But, you know, one of the things that became very dramatic is when Mulligan took the stand, former Judge Robert Mulligan. And then you found out there that basically he existed in the same universe. He was not necessarily. I mean, you can certainly make the point that probably he wasn't aggressive about sidestepping things, but he certainly, you know, he didn't conform to the strict rules and regs that he was supposed to and sign off on certifications and stuff like that. And basically what emerged was the fact that this is essentially a turf fight. It was a turf fight between the judges and the legislature in terms of them sort of investing this in O'Brien. But I mean, you know, that became very clear. I mean, O'Brien's lawyer was masterful in just deconstructing Mulligan on the stand and basically saying, you know, you're the flip side of the equation here. You know, why is it okay for you and not okay for my guy?
And why is it not okay that we saw Mulligan on the stand? Let's take a couple of quick calls. We have Peter Gelsinus from the Boston Herald here. Tana, I believe that's your name, from Cohasset. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I just have a quick question. I don't know how quick it is. With Martha Coakley, running for office now, do you think this is just a query that she's going to get into this at this point with the legislatures and the DeLeo and all that? I'm just curious about how is she going to bring this into her campaign or is she going to avoid it?
Well, two things. One, she has almost no choice to. First of all, she put out a statement yesterday. Charlie Baker, in our estimation, I think I'm speaking for Marjorie here, is going to talk about it nonstop in this campaign about one party rule as he did in his statement yesterday. But while that partially answers your question that she'll have no choice, keep in mind Martha Coakley prosecuted John O'Brien unsuccessfully for different reasons involved with Tim Cahill, the former treasurer, and his wife and that sort of thing. And O'Brien was acquitted in that case. So it isn't like she was soft. The problem is when you're running for governor and you need the support of Democrats, how hard can you be on Democrats?
Well,
it's a real test for
this
her.
This is going to be my opinion is she's going to look really bad on this because Charlie Baker is going to make over and over the point that Martha Coakley has not prosecuted anybody on Beacon Hill. It's been the
feds. She prosecuted John O'Brien.
But not the big cases. She didn't go after Diane Wilkerson, the woman that was the state senator for putting cash in her bra. She didn't go after these people.
She didn't go after Arroyo, the firefighter.
She didn't go after Arroyo, the firefighter. The feds have come in to do most of the big cases on Beacon Hill. So he's, I think, will make the argument that, fairly or unfairly, that she's, and also she recommended people for jobs.
Tana, thank you for the call. Mike, you're in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye?
Oh, that's a previous caller.
Oh.
From Cohasset. She's hanging up.
Oh, Mike, are you there? No, you're not.
Yes.
Oh, you are. I'm sorry. My apologies, Mike. You're on. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, I'm calling because I don't have any sympathy for Speaker DeLeo's proclamations that he was badly done by. Yes, his name came up, but lots and lots of ordinary people have their names come up in legal proceedings, and they don't get all kinds of public sympathy about it. I'm sure he would not have preferred to be there on the witness stand, to be there under federal criminal charges where he claims he would have been able to vindicate his name. He doesn't deserve a position better than the rest of folks whose names come up in all kinds of legal proceedings all the time when they're not defendants or they're not subject to having something done to them. And I don't have any particular sympathy for the U.S. Attorney's Office. I think there's plenty of things wrong there. But Speaker DeLeo, I suggest, does not deserve any particular sympathy.
Well, yeah, let me just say, you're totally right, obviously, Mike, that other people have suffered similar fates. But the fact that they have unfairly suffered that fate, I'm not speaking to, I mean, I shouldn't even say guilt or innocence because he hasn't been charged, but whether or not he was a party to all this, you may be right about that. But I think Carmen Ortiz's tactics and her unwillingness to the U.S. attorney to explain yesterday when the case was over why he was not indicted, why he was not called. I don't know if it creates sympathy, to use your word, Mike, but let me just say one other thing, is what DeLeo has done that nobody else has done on Beacon Hill. DeLeo has faced the media and at least told his side of the story. Terry Murray is one example, who's the Senate president, recommended a guy who was a heroin addict, who was deemed, quote, woefully unqualified for the job, and he got it, by the way, by one of the judges on the hiring panel. He was fired 2 years later for heroin possession. She runs by – she does not have the courage or the decency to respond to the people of the state in her district. So I guess the one point I'd give him is at least he's saying something. But, Mike, thank you for the call.
So one last question to you, Mr. Gelsenis. Yes. You did not end your comment on an optimistic note, the idea that this will cause a chill on Beacon Hill and that they'll try to be more on the up and up when they're recommending people for jobs. You don't think that's going to happen?
I think
they'll
be wearing sweaters for a little while. But, you know, the notion that this is going to disappear from our landscape is, I think, you know, if you want to, I said this to you last night on the phone, if you want to set up a situation that is a little stronger, then, you know, make these jobs civil service or something. I mean, put in a situation that's clear for everybody to understand and less likely to have somebody tamper with.
You know what? You know why there'll be a chilling effect, in my opinion? I hate the sound. When people say things like this, I hate it, so I'm going to say it anyway. The press can't forget this thing. For all of the legislators involved in this who have run away from cameras and microphones and notepads, they have to be asked questions about this everywhere they go, every place they go, until they've responded in a credible way to this thing. And then ultimately, if they know we're not going to forget, why are you making a face at me? If they know we're not going to forget, then they won't do it again.
There's not enough reporters to do that anymore, Jim.
I think on just my, for whatever it's worth, I mean, I like I said, I know John Immobile pretty well. And, you know, I do think, you know, notwithstanding what the judge warned them on, I think one of the things, if you were talking about, you know, whether it would be helpful to them or not, or at least it would be illuminating if one of them were to give us an indication, one of the defendants were to give us an indication of where they're at with this in terms of what they thought they were doing and what they, you know, taking that thing. I mean, none of them took the stand, and there are going to be appeals. It's not over in that regard.
Harry Mannion thinks they're going to win an appeal.
Right,
but they may
right,
have
but
to
I just
begin
think that,
serving their time before that's the unanswered question, too. They're going to be sentenced in November. Do they have to begin serving time before the appeal, or will they be out on bail pending the appeal?
They
I
could
don't know.
Be out on – I mean, the question is, obviously, they don't want to antagonize the judge and have him, you know, slap them with something extra. But I can't – I mean, this is just me, my feeling. I just think that, you know, it would be – interesting, to say the least, to have one of them give us, you know, their feelings about this, particularly on the idea of, you know, patronage, not patronage, if it went beyond that. And, you know, maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. I'm sure, you know, we'll try to go, you know, see if there's any possibility of that happening. Whether it does or not, I don't know.
Okay, Peter Gelsinas, great column today in the Boston Herald. There's a great chart in the Herald, too, about all the state agencies that could be next, right for a patronage investigation. You want to have some fun? Read that. Thank you very much, Peter, as
Thanks,
always.
Peter.
Up next, Brian Donovan is going to join us to talk.
We're going to hold Brian for a couple of minutes.
I'm sorry, I goofed that up. Up next is Roger Brown, the president of Berklee College of Music. He's going to join us to discuss affordable education, how the music industry is changing, and what Berklee is doing to address these issues. Stay tuned to that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This weekend, join WGBH and the Boston Globe for great music at the Boston Summer Arts Weekend. Saturday, we start off the festival with fun stuff for the kids and families, followed by all kinds of world acts, and then cap off the day with Los Lobos. Then on Sunday, we'll cool down with classical music from the Boston Landmarks Orchestra and jazz from Arturo Sandoval. See the entire lineup at bostonsummerarts.com. Presented by Citizens Bank.
Support for WGBH comes from you and Tanglewood, the summer home of the BSO in the Berkshire Hills, presenting the BSO, the Tanglewood Festival Chorus, and guest vocalists in works by Verdi and Rachmaninoff, July 27th. Tickets and information at tanglewood.org. And Roadside Attractions' A Most Wanted Man, the new spy thriller based on the novel by John le Carré, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, Rachel McAdams, Willem Dafoe, and Robin Wright. A Most Wanted Man, now in theaters.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again. So how do you get to Carnegie Hall? You know the punchline. Practice, practice, practice. Well, maybe it's time to change that refrain to Berklee, Berklee, Berklee. To date, 100 Berklee College of Music alums have received close to 240 Grammy Awards. College offers an impressive curriculum of online courses. They just introduced a graduate degree program on its Boston campus. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about the importance of a music education, how the music industry is changing, is Roger Brown. Roger's the president of Berklee College of Music. Roger, it's a pleasure to meet you.
It's good to be here. Thanks
great,
for having me.
Great to have you here, Roger Brown. So that was a wonderful, impressive introduction that Jim just gave to why
I like it.
Berklee's terrific.
I didn't hear it all, though. Maybe you should have it again.
But, you know, there had to be some parents out there listening to us right now who live in fear that their little drummer, like you were as a kid, are going to come home and say, senior in high school, Mom and Dad, I don't want to go to Harvard. I want to go to Berklee and be a musician. How do you convince these people that this is not a dead end? You'll be broke counting pennies for the rest of your life, Roger Brown, because you're not always going to make it big.
One of our great faculty members is Livingston Taylor.
One of our favorite guests, by the way. We love
him. He's amazing. He's amazing. And he has an opinion about every topic, even those he knows very little about. But I love Livingston. And he told me when I first got the job that he had been working at Harvard as a housemaster. And he said, here's the difference between Harvard and Berklee. When a young person is accepted to Harvard, it's after 18 years of effort on the a part of the entire extended family. When someone decides to go to Berklee, it's usually over the objections of the entire extended family, which is only partially true, but there's a seed of truth there. And part of what makes Berklee so special is our students have made a conscious decision to pursue music full tilt boogie. You know, this is what they're going after. It's a harder road than going to be an accountant or, you know, many other professions that are neatly laid out for you.
Why? Fewer jobs?
Well, no, it's a freelance world. Mm. So, you know, when you get done, there's no record label that shows up and says, we're going to hire 50 of you.
Yeah.
You know, you have to go to Brooklyn or L.A. or London or someplace and start writing songs or performing. So that makes it challenging. But I guess one of the points I make to parents all the time is this. Of the top 25 employers of Berklee grads, 7 are the biggest high-tech companies in the country. Apple, Microsoft, EMC, Cisco, IBM, et cetera. Because if you can compose great music, you can write software code. So training to be a musician does not mean you have to be a busking musician in the subway. There are actually a lot of, you know, impressive 21st century jobs that musicians can do if they choose to go that path. Also, another thing that's cool about being a musician is you could move to any city on the earth, put up a sign that says Berklee grad is teaching guitar lessons, and you'll get phone calls. So you're like a turtle. You kind of carry your profession on your back wherever you go. Now, you're not going to get rich that way, But you can get started without, you know, having to get a job with someone, you know, anywhere you go.
So being a personal entrepreneur is part of the mix for someone
absolutely.
To succeed. Yeah.
And that's part of what we're trying to focus on is how do we help not just the business entrepreneur, but the artistic entrepreneur get started, hang in there, do the work it takes to get their whatever it is, the songwriting or their performance jump started.
Who do you compete with? Who are your major competitors?
You know, there is no single competitor, but if you look at who do students go to when they don't go to us, there's no institution that gets more than 2 or 3% of them, but NYU is on that list because they have music, they have music engineering, they have music business, they sort of have the full suite of what we have. USC is on the list. Some specialized schools like Manhattan School of Music, New School. We don't really compete with the conservatories. You know, if you want to be a great symphonic player, you'd go to Curtis, Juilliard, NEC. We have a few of those who've come through our shop, but that's really not what we're designed for. So we compete with the jazz schools and those integrated universities.
You know, Roger Brown, president of Berkeley, when you do surveys, which I assume you do, of grads, alum, 10 years out, 20 years out, whatever it is, what percentage of them are still in the music business in some capacity, whether a music therapist, an artist themselves, a producer, what percentage?
That's a great question. 80% are making at least half their income from music, and 55% are full-time musicians. Now, they may be performing, they may be doing some shows, they may be teaching, they may be working at a school, but they're piecing together all their income from music. And I think that's a distinguishing factor of Berkeley versus a typical conservatory, is we're trying to train musicians for the music industry that exists now and will exist tomorrow. We're about contemporary music, not just jazz, but rock, pop, blues, hip-hop, Latin, film scoring, TV music, video game music. So we're trying to, you know, right now, Pandora, Spotify, these companies are crawling with Berkeley alumni who are creating these new music streaming companies.
You know, can we step back from this just for a second? Yeah, I'm looking at you, and I'm thinking of the kid who, in response to Marjorie's question, who's dying to go to Berkeley and be a musician. I understand how they got there. I can't quite understand how you got there. I mean, when you read your bio,
he was a drummer in Kenya.
You're doing some project with your wife in Sudan. You were the founder and president of Bright Horizons. And in the spirit of full disclosure, Marjorie and I
My
both alums to some
was
point,
a graduate of Bright Horizons,
which
That's
is
right.
this huge and wonderful childcare.
It is.
Empire,
it's
for
great.
Lack of a better expression. So how did Berkeley enter the mix for you, Roger?
Well, from the youngest age, I loved music, and I became a drummer, much to the objection of my school music leader who wanted me to play trombone. My mother played trombone in the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra.
You're kidding.
Great.
Which
the
is
trombone
pretty unusual
for a
female
woman.
Trombonist
yes.
in Atlanta. She said she wasn't any good, but she was good enough to be in the Atlanta Symphony. And they wanted me to play trombone. I said, no, I'm going to be a drummer. And, of course, they try to talk you out of it, and I insisted. And I became in my hometown, I was the go-to blues and rock drummer. And then in college, I discovered jazz, started playing jazz and jazz fusion. And by all the standards of the other places I've worked, I've usually been the best musician. And now I come to Berkeley, and I'm a humble, humble musician compared to even my students. I did... When I first got there, I auditioned to go through the process to simulate what it would feel like to be a student. And we have an 8-point scale that places you into ensembles, 8 being the top of the line. And almost no one gets 8s. And I got a 3 out of 8.
Oh.
So I
listen to Marjorie.
I'm sorry,
so
Roger.
I probably could have gotten in, but I wouldn't have been the top musician there, and I certainly would never have been hired to be on the faculty because our faculty are just on another planet. But I love music. I had this passion for music, and I think growing up in Georgia in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement, and you think back, my schools were segregated until the 7th grade.
Wow.
And my students can't believe that because they think that happened in 1866
exactly,
or something. I don't think you have the Civil Rights Movement without music. And the music that turned me on and opened my mind was James Brown, Sly and the Family Stone, Allman Brothers, interracial bands like Allman Brothers and the Doobie Brothers. And I just heard this music, and I heard the message of the music, and I said, wow, there's something wrong here. I remember listening to Southern Man by Neil Young and thinking, he's right. He is so right. I mean, all my friends were saying, who's this Canadian telling us how we should be? And I'm thinking, well, the truth is the truth, you know? So... I think music played a really important role in opening my own eyes to what was going on in the world, and I think it still does that.
We're talking to Roger Brown. He's the president of Berklee College of Music.
So how did you make the transition? And Jim mentioned before you and your wife worked in the Sudan, did a lot of great humanitarian work all around the world. But how did you go from starting Bright Horizons, which is now 45 countries it's in and hundreds of places? I mean, it's all over the place.
Not 45
countries. 45 states, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And many states.
In Europe, India, that kind of thing. Yeah. How did you go from Bright Horizons to Berklee? I mean, how did you make that
switch? Have a few passions. Yeah. One is education. My first job out of college was teaching math and physics in a small school in rural Kenya. And I've always felt like education is the way to change the world. So the theme of Bright Horizons, Berklee, my teaching in Kenya is all how do you – you know, educate young people and give them a better chance in the world. Another theme and passion is maybe growing up in a chicken farming town of 10,000 in rural Georgia, you either want to stay there for life or you want to get the heck out.
Yeah.
And I was in the latter category. So I love other cultures, and Berklee has kids from 101 different countries. I like entrepreneurship. I like starting things. I like imagining things that don't exist. And Berklee itself is a very entrepreneurial organization. So I have these interests. And, you know, I say to students all that, I think I'm a good role model for our students, because as a musician, you're not going to have an easy path laid out for you. You do what you love. You do it well. And that leads you to the next thing you do. And the path may look nonlinear, but I think in my case, it's all stuff I cared about, poured my heart into, and it, you know, one thing led to the next.
You know, there was something very interesting I read about what you're doing with the online education at Berklee, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. is a little bit different. Tell people about that.
Well, you know, one of the big problems in higher education is it's just way too expensive for most people, especially people even outside the, you know, we talk about it within the U.S., but what if you live in Rwanda and you want to be a great musician? You can't, it's hard to move to Boston and afford an American private college tuition. So you think, how do you let this information be shared at less expense? And online education is one way to do that. And there are actually some things that are probably easier to teach online, like things like music technology, than they are in the classroom. So we're pioneering and experimenting with how you do that. So we have an online school that now serves over 10,000 students, many of them some of the top musicians in the world. The guy who co-wrote some of Adele's greatest hits studies online with us. The bass player for the Dave Matthews Band, Stefan Lessard, studies online with us. So we can reach people who are in jobs and professions. They're not going to leave and move to Boston. We can do it at less expense because we don't have to have physical facilities in the Back Bay, which is a very expensive thing.
What
to
is
do.
It, 60% discount from what I read? Is that what it is, roughly?
It's 60% less than the on-campus tuition.
What is the on-campus tuition?
$37,000. Mm-hmm. So you don't get the same thing. You don't get the practice rooms, the counseling services. You don't get the concentration of people. But my vision is that ultimately it's not either or. Like, imagine you're a high school senior, you're bored out of your mind, you're a great musician. What if you could do your first year of Berklee online while you're still in high school and show up and only need to go for 2.5 or 3 years?
Yeah, but aren't you, Roger, one of the things about, I mean, online education makes a lot of sense for, as you say, for financial reasons. And if it turns out you're the bass player for Dave Matthews, then the reality is you're in the music business to begin with. I worry, and I'm sure you do too, about, does it create two classes mm-hmm. of education? Mm-hmm. And the piece of it that I think about here, how many kids, how many students at Berklee?
4,400.
Okay, so they're 4,400. It seems to me one of the great thrills and inspirations for a young musician in waiting or a musician is to be amidst those 44. Yeah. With the exception of people who, one, couldn't afford it, two, are so far away geographically they couldn't get here, and three, they're in the music business already, again, like as you mentioned a minute ago, Adele's songwriter and Dave Matthews person. Don't you worry that because of cost, people do it, and they don't come out with nearly the product that they would have had they come to Boston?
I worry about it, but I worry more about the young person who scrapes all their nickels and dimes together, comes to Boston, makes it through 3 semesters, drops out, has $40,000 of debt, no degree, and they got 3 semesters of Berklee. But what if they had done Berklee online for the first 4 semesters and then come and gotten a bigger scholarship and been able to graduate and get those 4 semesters on campus?
So do you urge people, do you say to people who are doing the online thing, we hope you're going to do this as a compliment to actually being here if you can be? Is that part of the marketing?
Well, we say
deal?
To them, look, it's up to you to create your education. We have an online option. We have an on-campus option. We have relationships with 19 international schools from Tel Aviv to Athens, Greece, to Seoul, South Korea. You can study there. We have 6 community college articulation agreements in the U.S. and Canada, so you can study at Miami-Dade for 2 years and then come to Berkeley. And yes, especially the kids who can't afford it, you know, we get a lot of dreamers. They've been told by Walt Disney since they're kids, if you just imagine it, it will be true. And there's, you know, you need a little bit of that to be a musician, but it'd be better to have that dreaming without $60,000 of debt. And you'll be in a better position to make your way if you're not worried about debt. So we tell them, look, if you can't afford us now, go to a community college and then come later. We'll hold a space for you. We let people defer up to 3 years without having to be readmitted. We articulate credits from those schools. We also have credit by exam. So if you show us you can do the harmony and ear training, you don't need to take it, and it counts as credit. You don't have to take other credit. So we're all about trying to make it more affordable and give people as much of that rich experience as we can. But we know that, you know, there are just a lot of people in the world who want what we have. We already have this class system in education. So we're trying to do things to just make Berkeley more accessible to the middle-class kid or the poor kid who just isn't going to be able to get through otherwise.
We're talking with Roger Brown, the president of Berklee College of Music. One last thing from me, Roger. You know, every time there's budget cuts in the public school system, music is one of the first things to go. You are surrounded by musicians all the time. What's your take on the impact of learning music, learning to read music, learning to memorize music, and the young people you see at Berkeley, how that changes them, their mind, their outlook, the whole thing?
You know, when you look at what parents who have the means choose to do in educating their children, they almost always insist that their children learn some music. And when you look at what affluent schools that have the resources do, they always have rich music programs. Why? Because we intuitively know that it makes you a better thinker. It helps you with memorization. It helps you with creativity and composition. The discipline of learning an instrument is something you can use no matter what you do. When you're trying to learn a new piece of software, the same tools you use to learn an instrument can help you in that. So I think we all intuitively know that's important. The good news is I think some of those school music programs are coming back. We're doing an interesting project in New York City now called Amp Up New York City, where we're training 600 New York City public school teachers in modern band methods, giving them guitars, basses, keyboards, and drum sets, and they're turning their kids loose to play Adele as opposed to John Philip Sousa. I love Sousa. I played maybe a little too much Sousa when I was in school band, but, you know, our theory is let's let kids play the music they're passionate about. And then they'll discover all the rest of the musical world as they kind of work their way back through music history.
You know, a couple more things for me, Roger Brown. You have this new your first graduate program, right? Why is that as significant as some of my friends in the music business are telling me it is? Why is that such a big deal?
Well, when I first got to Berkeley, I did a survey, and I found out that 10% of our undergraduates already have a bachelor's degree. They tend to be some of those Livingston students whose parents said, okay, if you finish at Columbia, I'll let you go to Berkeley. So we have kids from the most prestigious schools on the planet who then come to Berkeley, and they don't really want another bachelor's degree. What they really would want is a master's degree, but we never had one to offer. So these are small, elite, customized programs for those people who might have gone to a more traditional music school and want to round that out with a little bit of Berkeley. Or, you know, we have a young man who got a math degree from Columbia at Berkeley now, and he's just a passionate musician, and that's what he really wants to do. So I think the master's programs, again, it gives people more what they want. Because Berkeley has been so unique, sometimes people seek us out even if we're not exactly offering the degree they need.
So, Rod, how good are your alums? I mean, you have some of your alums are people who are just at the top of their field. John Mayer is one of my favorite musicians, even though I hear he's not the most wonderful person. You may know otherwise.
You know, I'll dispute that. John says some unfortunate things in public, but he has come back several times and done clinics for our students.
That's what I want to know. Is that the norm?
That guy, not only did he spend a whole week with 12 songwriters, he recorded their songs and played on them without asking for anything.
That's pretty great.
He gave them a digital recorder so that, you know, for a songwriter, whenever you get an idea, you don't want to lose it. And, you know, that's the story about him. It's unfortunate in a way. He's got a little bit of that kind of bad boy rock star thing going. Maybe that's even conscious. I don't know. But what I've seen from John is he's a very caring guy who really took good care of these students.
Who else is good to you of the people who have some prominence?
A guy named Juan Luis Guerra, the biggest Dominican bachata merengue star. He's a huge star in Latin America. He's incredibly generous to us. Branford Marsalis is great to us. Kevin Eubanks, Passion Pit. Those guys are
really?
All but one are Berklee alums. Imagine Dragons, three of them are Berklee people.
My younger daughter Esperanza. Would be drooling if she's listening to this interview,
yeah,
I should say.
I'm sure you and your audience don't really know these people, but American authors, Lucius, Betty Hu, Kaiza, we've got more really, really young alums tearing it up out there than we've ever had. And almost every single one of them has a producer or a manager or a band of other Berklee people. So one of the things that's cool is when Esperanza Spalding becomes really successful, she brings along with her this comet tail of opportunity for other people, the players, the producers, the arrangers, the business people. And in Kaisa's case, in Betty Hu's case, in Carmen's case, the whole strategy that allowed them to become really famous was laid out for them by a classmate who was studying music business.
You know, before you leave, Roger, we said to you that we mentioned on the air at the beginning of this, don't want people to think there's something deeper than this, that we're both alums of Bright Horizons. And the story we told you, Marjorie calls me, I don't know, 15 years ago, when her kids are young and my kids are young, and I was gone out of my mind taking care of them, one particularly, the two young daughters, and she says, have I found the place for you? Hmm. And you had this thing in the, is it the basement? Can I call it the basement?
Yeah. Star
of the Star Market on Com Ave, where it turns into Brighton Ave, whatever it is, where you could deposit your children for the most spectacular childcare with great workers. And as Marjorie said this morning to you, a normal half-hour shop became a three-hour shop because of the. It was brilliant and wonderful.
Well, you could dump the kids. I mean, what is the biggest hassle in the world when your kids are little, taking them shopping? I want the candy. I want this. I want that. I want that. They're climbing out of the carriage. I mean, it's like a nightmare. And to be able to go when your kids are little and you can't get away from them, plop them somewhere and go shopping and cruise slowly down the aisle.
So my point was that not only have a lot of your alums brought joy into our lives, the child care center beneath Star Market brought great joy. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
I was going to say two things. One, when I first started at Berklee, I met all these former Bright Horizons students who had now arrived at Berklee.
That's great.
And I said to their parents, you thought you had stopped paying me tuition 13 years ago.
That's right.
So I was a little –
right.
And I said, someday I'm going to have assisted living for you. That'll be my next career.
Was your first one at Kendall Square?
Yeah, that was the very first one.
That's,
that's the one all three of my children went to.
Yep, mine too, the
And
Kendall
they've all
Square.
Turned out pretty good.
That's right. I owe it all to you, Roger Brown, your lovely wife, Linda Mason.
And you had a second point you wanted to make?
Well, the other point was in that Star Market program, one of the cool ideas that one of our teachers came up with was to create sort of like a shop. You know how kids love to pull cereal boxes off? So we created this shopping experience so they could do that under careful supervision of trained early childhood educators.
No one was better at pulling cereal boxes off the shelf than my younger daughter. Roger Brown, it's great to see you. Good luck
here
at Berklee.
I love your
Sounds
show.
Great.
I appreciate what you all are doing
for
Boston.
Thank you so much,
and
Roger.
Thank you very much for coming in. Roger Brown, if you haven't guessed, he is the president of Berklee College of Music. Great to talk to you, Roger.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Up next, a Celtic Sojourn's Brian O'Donovan joins us for a preview of Boston Arts Summer Weekend, which is this weekend. You're going to hear all about it on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, is Jibo the family robot one step closer to HAL or R2-D2? If you missed Christina Quinn's innovation story on the radio, check it out at WGBHnews.org right now.
Bring a little art into your life and support your community through public broadcasting when you take part in the WGBH Fine Art Auction. It's all online at auction.wgbh.org.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and Citizens Bank, presenting sponsor of the WGBH Boston Globe Summer Arts Weekend. Free music this Saturday and Sunday in Boston's Copley Square. You can see the lineup at bostonsummerarts.com. And Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru XV Crosstrek Hybrid with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at subaruofnewengland.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again here with us in Studio 3 for a preview of Boston Summer Arts Weekend. Is one of our favorites. Brian O'Donovan is host of A Celtic Sojourn. Brian, good to see you.
Great to be back with you guys, Jim and Marjorie.
Well, we get to see the great video which previews what this whole weekend is about, but many people listening don't know. So tell us, please, what's the deal?
Well, Boston Summer Arts Weekend was a concept that came up a number of years ago. John Abbott, our CEO here, and Chris Mayer, who was the publisher of The Globe at the time, had a concept of coming up with a free outdoor festival in one of the more beautiful spaces in Boston, that's Copley Square. And they got some underwriters, most notably Citizens Bank, to write a big check to support this outdoor free activity. And we put it together with a big team from all of those organizations, and now it's entering its third year.
Now, I'm going to be the first of the two of us to admit that we have not been there.
I have not been there.
And we're both looking at each other and saying, why? Is this the third one?
Third year.
Now, the first and most important thing to some of us is free. I know the most important thing to you is the level of talent and participation, but it is on the house, correct?
Absolutely. And you know, seriously, that's a big issue, Jim, for us here at GBH and everybody involved in it as a team. You know, how to feel good about something, about being involved in something that's delivering this level of artistic endeavor free to anybody who just shows up. It's a great thing for the city, and we feel very, very proud of it.
And the most exciting part to me, I have to say, is I didn't know how broad the spectrum of performers was. To say that you have everything from different kinds of dance to different kinds of music, that is a totally fair statement. Give us a sense, give us a taste of what people will see Saturday and Sunday.
Well, what you're talking about, it is indeed all over the map, but in a good way and in an invitational way. And that's by design, largely. What we are saying to people is, even if you don't like jazz, come and see this performer, Arturo Sandoval. You will be blown away. You might never have thought...
Presidential Medal of Freedom this year,
absolutely,
did he not?
Absolutely.
From Barack Obama.
Absolutely, and a great speech. And he talked about, you know, he defected from Cuba, worked with Dizzy Gillespie, just an amazing artist. So there's a good example. You thought you didn't like jazz, you like jazz after Arturo. You thought you didn't like classical music, come and see Anna Kiko Myers playing Vivaldi's Four Seasons with the Landmarks Orchestra.
She is awesome.
She is just quite amazing.
She is awesome.
So it's all, you know, the list goes on and on. You didn't think you liked dance, come and see the Step Crew from Canada who put together this spectacular show. And it's on and on. It's invitational. We are huge arts advocates here. I am personally a live music advocate and an activist, I've been called in actual fact, to say that there is nothing like live music. And to be able to platform it in the most beautiful space in the city, I think as well, Marjorie, it's really the best space in the city is Copley Square.
But tell us also, because there's a whole thing for families that starts tomorrow at 11 o'clock. So this is a great opportunity, too, to bring the little brats along.
Is definitely, and calm them down or hype them up, depending on what you're talking about. But it is, we deliberately designed that again. Of course, WGBH is very committed to family education, entertainment. And these groups that we put together specifically at this time from 11 o'clock tomorrow morning until about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it's all about families. And it's not just entertainment, a lot of interactivity, a lot of cool things happening there. And families come and stretch out in the lawn. They come downtown, they see Boston, and they get into entertained at the highest levels.
It's something called the Gizmo Guys is going to be there a little bit after noontime tomorrow. What are the Gizmo Guys, please?
Well, they're kind of what you would imagine. They got a lot of gizmos, and they move them around. They juggle. They interact with the kids. As I said, they've got machines. They've got just wicked cool stuff. I stand there, and I'm just amazed at them myself at my tender young age of 56. I love those Gizmos guys and what they have and what they bring to the mix. Steve Songs is there as well. Debbie and Friends. Lots of kind of standard sing-alongs, balloons, face painting, and of course our GBH PBS characters.
This is a rain or shine kind of deal, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Even though it's going to be a beautiful weekend and we're looking forward to that, but it always is a rain or shine type deal.
Are you nervous? I mean, every time I speak to someone who's dealing with large events, I get anxious and I have nothing to do with them. It's the day before. You cycled back from Copley Square a few minutes ago. Comes into our studio all sweaty. It was horrible, actually.
Yeah, that wasn't even from the cycling. I just sweat generally.
So you
thank you. So Brian, people talk about you around the station here.
So Brian O'Donovan, I don't know you well enough. Are you the kind of guy who is antsy, anxious today, the day before, that everything's got to go right, or no?
Well, I claim not to be, but you can see that I'm fidgeting with a piece of
yes,
paper here in the studio, and of course you're anxious that things go well in a public environment like this, when a lot of people are depending on you. We've got the best team across all of those groups, like the Globe, other folks here at GBH, and of course Citizens Bank and all of the sponsors. But you're anxious, and you refer to weather. I reckon I'm going to have to coin or go to German or Yiddish or something for a word that describes a particular pain in an event producer's life, and that's the pain of weather ruining something like this. But we had rain one year and we got through it. In fact, it was for Suzanne Vega on stage.
I love Suzanne
about 500-600 people showed up with ponchos and umbrellas, and they said, the heck with this weather, we're going to enjoy it.
So where is rain or shine. This is a Copley Square, as we know, but where is the stage?
The stage is, you know, Copley Square, Marjorie, as I said, is the most beautiful space to me, public space in Boston. It's the closest thing we have to kind of like an Italian piazza.
Yeah.
It has three beautiful historic buildings bordering it. Trinity Church, the Copley, the Fairmont Copley now, that historic hotel, and then Boston Public Library. Is there a more beautiful building in Boston? So we build the stage with the Trinity Church in the back of the stage, so it's facing the public library. And then you've got the beautiful modern John Hancock Tower right there, you know, reflecting everything. So it really is a gorgeous space and worth seeing for its own sake.
Isn't the reflection, since you mentioned, isn't the reflection of the church in that building one of
stunning.
The most beautiful things ever?
And a design feature, obviously.
It is really.
That's a stunning building.
So what's the time? What's the time frame? What's the whole deal over the weekend, Brian?
Well, 11 o'clock tomorrow, as I said, we'll get going with the family affair until about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Then we've got amazing, we've got a steampunk. You look like you'd know what steampunk is, Jim.
Well, I would like to say, yes, I do, in the hopes that you wouldn't say, well, then tell people what it is. So since I'm not going to take that chance, I cannot tell a lie. What is a steampunk?
It's hard to really describe, but it's a contemporary circus kind of act with hundreds of people playing all sorts of instruments. Just a really fun thing.
Oh, I love that.
You talked about Berkeley. You talked with the wonderful Roger Brown earlier on. Shun Ng is how it's pronounced. NG is his last name. Singapore-based from Chicago. Just an amazing guitarist coming along after that. Huge dance extravaganza from Canada, exploring American tap and Irish step and everything happening at about 4 o'clock. Then we've got some really cool things. Blue Man Group is doing a drumming competition.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's kind of off to the side stage. We've got a whole side stage that isn't very obvious, but there's so many amazing things happening there as well.
Speaking of side stage, I mean, there obviously, when you look down this list, by the way, what's the website for this thing?
The website is just simply bostonsummerarts.com.
Bostonsummerarts.com.
I mean, it's a great lineup. A
lot of great gets, but the one get, I'm amazed. How did you get Edgar B. Herwick III to be one of the key MCs for Saturday? How'd you pull that off?
We had connections through the White House. It started, and eventually they got to Edgar, and he agreed, as long as it could be a private jet, to fly him there.
Well, it sounds fabulous, Brian.
Amazing.
It really does.
He's a big part of it because he's got such a personality.
Yes,
and he's been
does.
There for 3 years, so it's going to be great to have him back.
Did you mention Los Lobos at 9:45 on Saturday night?
Well, that's going to be a rockin' night.
That's going to be absolutely fantastic.
Right in Copley Square again. People love to get up and dance, Marjorie. It's going to be great.
I've actually seen Los Lobos, and they are really
top notch.
We're rooting for you, Brian. We hope the weather is great, not too hot, not too humid, and not too much rain. So I hope it goes very well.
It's going to be.
Thank you so much for being here. What's the website one more time?
BostonSummerArts.com.
BostonSummerArts.com.
Thanks, Brian, very much. Good luck.
Thank you,
for
guys.
Coming
Sounds
with us.
Great.
Brian O'Donnell from the Celtic Sojourn. Thank you for being here. You can listen to Brian, the Celtic Sojourn, too, every Saturday at 3 o'clock. Correct?
Certainly can.
Okay, thank you very much. Up next is Emily Rooney with her famous list of obsessions and observations and some opinions on the news of the week. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
For Richard Nixon, secrecy was king.
All files, any correspondence or anything that has to do with between me and any member of my staff belong to the president, not to them.
Almost 40 years since the president's resignation, a look at the tapes he protected until his death. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you. and UMass Lowell offering part-time graduate and undergraduate degrees online or on campus. Fall classes start September 3rd at UMass Lowell. You can learn more at continuinged.uml.edu. And State Street, partnering with institutional investors worldwide to create the way ahead, and proud to support TED Radio Hour in the Innovation Block each Thursday at 11 p.m. here on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3, as she is every Friday for open mic. And her list of obsessions and observations is with her. That would be Emily Rooney. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Emily Rooney. We're going to start with some of the news of the week.
Okay.
We spent the first half hour of the show today talking about the verdict in the probation trial. If people don't know that the three defendants, a lot of us were surprised, were found guilty of racketeering and mail fraud involving rigging jobs in the probation department. What do you think of the verdict, Emily Rooney?
I wasn't on board with it.
No,
I wasn't. I know they did this. They all did it. And I'm glad that it's been rooted out. I'm glad we've discovered that especially the probation department was at the heart of this patronage thing. But everybody was in on it. I mean, undeniably, all the legislature was in on it, along with the probation department. That's how they knew.
And the judges.
Everybody.
Yep.
And it reminds me of – I keep falling back on the John Connolly case. And John Connolly, the corrupt FBI agent, he was. But so were all the others in the FBI office at the time. And only one person took the fall. And I don't think it's right.
By the way, that's not wildly different from
what
your
I
position
think, too.
Is where
it's,
were the legislators?
It's
where
like
were
the
judges?
Or it's like the Whitey Bulger trial where you had people that were – the FBI the corruption in the FBI was widespread. And you're right. Only John Connolly took the fall. Although
and only Whitey Bulger. It's like – and he was right. I mean, there was
we
much
have,
more
I think
to
we
it.
Should have sent Whitey to jail.
Well,
there's, I'm
I have
down
no
with
problem
that.
With that. I'm
well,
no problem
it's good
with
to
that.
Hear, Emily.
But there is a certain
– I'm not soft on crime, Jim. That's not my position.
I know you are not.
But one of the things – I mean, that it becomes – the older I get, the clearer and clearer it becomes. There's no rhyme or reason to some of this stuff. You had John Monterano admitted to killing
20-some
people. 19 people. And he gets an 11-year deal to testify against Whitey Bulger.
He's walking around selling books.
And
collecting Social Security, if I remember correctly.
And you have people that did rig the system facing 20 years in jail.
Yeah.
It seems a little nutty. I don't think they're going to do 20 years. But they might do the same thing, the same amount as Kevin Weeks, who participated in digging up
bodies.
And by
the way, if they hadn't gone along with it, they would have lost their jobs. You know, because, we had to get a guy in there who'll hire the people we want him to hire.
The response to that is then you have to lose your job. If that's the case, if there's corruption, you got to do it. But, you know, the thing that is most frustrating to me, and I'm a little less sympathetic than you, is not one single person. We had Harry Mannion on today, Carmen Ortiz, U.S. Attorney. Yesterday was asked the question repeatedly. I'm still waiting for a credible answer as to why the legislators who were part of this plot were not co-defendants in this case. I have not heard one decent argument.
And yet they were allowed to be called unindicted co-conspirators during trial, which is pretty outrageous.
Outrageous. And pretty odd. I've never seen this kind of thing before.
I mean, there's still a grand jury going on, but is that for future?
Well, we asked Harry Mannion, who called from Chicago a few minutes ago, who's a pretty noted lawyer in these parts, who's at his father-in-law's 80th birthday or something in Chicago, about whether or not it is credible to think that O'Brien and his two defendants could conceivably flip and provide
maybe
testimony against, well, he didn't think it was.
I mean, I can tell you this, Sal DeMacy did not turn anybody in. I mean, they tried to get him with the grand jury more than a year ago. He didn't turn anybody in.
Yeah. Well, what's going to be interesting is what happens now, because as Mannion also said, it's very possible that one of these defendants will decide, rather than go to jail for a long time, that they will.
I think it's too late for that. No. Once you've been convicted, you can't start bartering for.
Oh yeah, Mannion said for sentence purposes, you absolutely can. Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know.
It's totally relevant to sentencing.
Sentencing's not
till November 8th.
What are they gonna barter?
You provide information that leads to the indictment of other people who are not now indicted, and at least that's what Mannion said.
It's going to have to be Bob DeLeo or I don't know.
I don't think it's happening either, but at least he says it's plausible.
Good luck.
You know, speaking of the news, another big case that was, I have to say, stunning. On NECN, every single night for a week or two, 9 months ago, we took the live press conference from New Hampshire with a weeping mother, the attorney general up there talking about the disappearance into nowhere of Abigail Hernandez. 9 months later, almost to a day, this teenager reappears and is home, but with virtually no answers
Zero.
As to where she was or what happened.
Yeah, we're doing this on Beat the Press.
Oh, you are?
Tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I went back and looked at everything today. I mean, hundreds of news stories back from when she first disappeared. And, you know, they had enlisted the public support, the media support. Everybody was kind of on board helping with this disappearance because people didn't know whether it was a runaway or a kidnapping case or what it was. But now that she has returned home, you know, like the skids are on. And my issue is their right to privacy versus the public's right to know. I think at this point, the balance goes to the public. They spent thousands, who knows how much. They searched rivers and ponds and hundreds of acres of woods. Law enforcement, every day they had one of those press conferences. And it wasn't just one cop. It was a, you know, a battalion of people. You know, the mother. And then the mother was very secretive. Remember when that letter appeared right around Thanksgiving?
Mm-hmm.
What the heck was in the letter? What did she say? Oh, I'm with my boy. Oh, what did she say? You know, and why wasn't that public? So at some point, they're going to have to come clean with this. And now this this sketch has appeared of somebody who allegedly she went away with in October. But who
that
is
that sketch,
it?
By the way, looks like every single
of
person
course,
I know.
Ridiculous.
I mean, it's a ridiculous
sketch. Which the girl could be just a flagrant liar for all we know.
But while you are right, the family is saying we hope you respect our privacy. What the prosecutors are saying, I have no idea how much legitimacy there is to this, is not only that we want you to respect their privacy, but we don't want to disclose any information that would interfere in our criminal investigation. You don't buy that either.
No, I don't buy it. What criminal investigation? Is this a kidnapping? And if so, don't we have the right to know? If you know who the suspect is or you think you know, don't all the mothers of 11 and 13-year-olds up there want to know who it is?
Exactly. Well,
so what's the agenda?
Well, I think that the agenda here is what we talk about all the time, is a refusal of the government to disclose the information that they need to disclose to people and their ability to get away with it because we don't press hard enough. They need to say, was this young woman abducted?
Yeah. Well, no surprise. No one called me back today, Marjorie.
Well, the thing is, if she was abducted, then we need to be on the lookout and still concerned. If she ran off with some guy and spent 9 months with
was it an internet entrapment? What was it?
Exactly. Then we need to know that as well. Or if not, you need
First of all, is this girl compos mentis? I mean, can't they just ask her what happened?
Well, she
well,
obviously knows what happens.
But you both raise a wonderful point. The minimum they should be providing, even if they won't provide all the details that you both seem to think are legitimate, is to say we can assure you that this is not something that puts any other person at risk.
They haven't even done that. I don't think we have to go into, in some of these cases, when we have to go into the blow-by-blow of what happened to this poor teenager, if it was some kind of sexual assault. Or we don't need to know that. But we need to know whether people should be afraid.
Afraid, exactly.
And that's,
whether there's a danger.
Yeah.
Imminent danger. You know, a lot of this is, it feels like podunk to me. You know, like it's so clumsy. And nobody really has a grand strategy.
Are the state police involved
with
this?
Well, see, I don't know how it works in New Hampshire because the state police would be involved if it was Massachusetts, but I'm not sure in New Hampshire.
I'm quite sure, if I recall, and please email in if I'm wrong, I'm quite sure that the state police were part of those press conferences were held virtually every single night for a couple of weeks. And by the way, I know everybody knows this already, in addition to the sketch being out, she returns 9 months later in the exact same outfit, apparently.
What's up with that?
That she disappeared in. The whole
she's been
thing
wearing the same
is,
clothes for 9 months?
I guess they had a little washer-dryer right there in wherever they were staying, I guess.
And by the way, the letter you're talking about, just if we weren't clear, is the mother acknowledged having received the letter
from the daughter.
From Abigail, her
and
the
they
daughter.
Also lied about the timeline on that. That lies a strong word. But the letter was written 10 days after she disappeared, and then they didn't make that public until like 2 months later. I was like, why?
Yeah, they have an obligation. See, the family is hiding behind this. Okay,
they're happy. It's
they're
nice
going to
she's
ruin
back,
the investigation, but that's not legitimate. And I hope that the media up in New Hampshire keeps on this case because people
you
do
think
have,
somebody would break and say what happened.
That's what I'm surprised by. Yeah. I have to say, I'm surprised. You know, Emily,
I keep thinking she was in the basement the whole time
of her own house.
Of her own house. Okay, that was Emily.
Yeah, I know.
Now, Emily, I want you to know my favorite person. Let's see if you know who this person is. My favorite person of the week. I should actually have a favorite person of the week every week. Is Carlos Slim.
I know
you know
Carlos.
Who he is?
Of course.
Second richest man in the world.
He owned part of the New York Times for a long time.
Mexican billionaire. Yep. And the reason I love him is he's campaigning on something I've been campaigning on wildly unsuccessfully my whole adult life. I want a 4-day work week. He wants what you have during the summer, which is a 3-day work week. What this guy has proposed is Essentially, it's a compressed work week, meaning you don't work that many fewer hours. You work three 11-hour days. Yeah. You have to work till you're 70 or 75 so they have the maximum productivity. Is there any reason in 2014 with the technology we have that apply to most jobs why we couldn't at least compress from 5 to 4, if not to 3?
I mean, I have this theory, and we were talking about this the other day in the newsroom, that most jobs are a waste of time. I mean, you spend a lot of time doing things other than your actual job, day, minute. I mean, and then, you know, don't everybody email me at once, because I know people are very, very busy. And there are a lot of jobs that you're, you know, hospitals and surgeons and all that. But the day-to-day office grind, you know, is not all that taxing for a lot of people. It's a lot of wasted time.
A lot of meetings.
A lot of, oh, my goodness. This is like Meeting Central right here at WGBH. It is, isn't it? And there's no... there's no efficiency to anything. I mean, it's like you have a meeting here and it's 2.5 hours. It's not like, you know, 29 minutes. You know, it's just different. Everything has its own culture. But
yeah,
this is a good example of that.
You know, every time we have this discussion, Marjorie and I have been talking about this on the air for 15 years. A ton of people call in and say, well, yeah, but you need to have the place staffed on every. So the answer is you have rotating three and 4 day weeks.
Right.
Jane Doe works these 4 days or 3 days. John Doe works the others.
Firefighters.
That's
a perfect example. Two 24-hour shifts, and then they can go off to their other job the rest of the week.
Airline workers, flight attendants, pilots do a lot of the same thing. And by the way, the research, I did a piece in the Globe for this a year ago. The research suggests overwhelmingly that if your week is compressed, even if you have fewer hours, this proves your point, that almost everybody gets all, if not more than all of the work done.
Yeah,
one, because of the excitement of having more time to live your life. And number two, because you have to get it done in a shorter period of time.
Every
so there's not all that wasted energy.
Stretches to the time required. So, I mean, if you got to be here 8 hours, it's going to take you 8 hours. If you're only going to be here 4 hours, it'll only take you 4 hours. That's just the way it works.
No. I remember going back after I had my first kid, and I realized I had to get out on time because I had to get
home for
the babysitter. And it was amazing how efficient
I became. Exactly, right.
So what was I doing here all these years? I was schmoozing. I was going from desk to
desk. Coffee and cigarette break.
Potato chips. Yeah, cigarette break. Those were the days when it was like everybody smoking a furnace.
Exactly.
And suddenly I became this machine of efficiency, which I know you find odd because I think you think I'm totally inefficient.
But I find that relatively odd. Now, let me just say one last thing about this before we leave this topic, because I'm obsessed with it. For those who say, well, this is such a radical outlying idea, 4 out of 10 American workplaces currently offer some sort of compressed work week to some of their employees. It's not that outrageous. John Huntsman, the former Republican governor of Utah, he, on his way out of office, it was subsequently repealed by the legislature a few years later, established a 4 day work week for every public employee
that
in Utah.
Sense.
He said it was saving a ton. I talked to him, a ton of energy, ton of commuting time, all that sort of thing. But ultimately,
state
it was repealed for political reasons.
Definitely do it.
Amen. And a lot of local governments are doing it. Okay, enough of current events.
You think they're wasting a lot of time in state government?
Yeah, I do. And that, no more so than anyone else. I mean, I'm not one of the. I do not bash on public employees. Not their salaries. Nothing.
No. Okay. By the way, I did just since you brought. I did a little research. Not conclusive. I believe they can rig as many jobs in 4 days
as
they do in 5. Thank you. Okay, here's what you waited for. Let's hear it.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not? This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy. It's your right. Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Now, we know she has no interest. Now, every week I ask Emily if the list is thematic. Why don't you ask her today instead, Marjorie?
Emily Rooney, is your list thematic?
As a matter of fact, it is.
Oh, perfect.
I'm back to my
your old self.
My old self.
Okay.
Go ahead, Emily.
What is your theme?
So the theme this week is questions I hate being asked.
Oh, I like this.
All right. Yeah, you're going to like this. And I don't mean questions like how old are you or how much do you weigh or stuff like that. Because those are questions you can easily avoid or lie about.
Yep, that's true.
So that has nothing to do with my topic.
Okay.
All right. So I hate it when somebody asks me, what are you reading? It is so pretentious. It drives me out of my mind. I always want to come up with something like War and Peace. I mean, it's just like, why are you asking me that? And it always comes out of the blue, like you're sitting in a restaurant with somebody or something. It's like, what are you reading? What? It's like.
So what is your response? What? Is that what you say to people?
Usually.
Okay,
usually.
Good.
Or I say,
it
probably,
is pretentious.
Probably what you guys say, which is, I read so much, I can't even. I mean, it's like we read books for our jobs and all that kind of stuff. It's like,
I'm reading something really good.
But sometimes I grab a book when I'm, you know, at the lake house or something, some trashy thing. It's like, why am I telling? I'm not going to tell anybody.
It's outrageous. What's your next thing you don't like
reading? Let me just give a plug to this.
Yeah. What is it?
I'm reading Gray and Green's The End of the Affair from my book club.
Oh.
two thumbs up. Plus, it's only like 150 pages long.
Yeah, that is good.
Very sexy.
So Marjorie, she didn't mind sharing with what she's
right. Ahead.
Now, this one is a personal one, but it bugs me.
Okay.
It's like, who are you dating? First of all, I don't talk about my personal life, in case you guys haven't noticed. And it's like, why would I tell that to somebody who would just... People in my situation, you probably feel this
who
too,
asked that? Who asked that
Everybody.
Question?
Everybody. I mean,
because she's single.
Sometimes
that's why.
In a celebrity.
For 5 minutes.
What do you say to that?
It's usually something pretty rude.
I bet you probably. That's. I bet you probably. Do.
That is very personal.
Yeah. I mean.
Yeah.
Why
that's
would
rude.
Somebody, so. But it's one of those things that I don't. It's like, what are you reading? I don't really see it coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so suddenly it's there. And even worse, is your daughter dating anyone? Now that bugs me.
Like it's their business.
Like it's their or mine. I mean, if you
well,
know.
Go ask her if you want to know.
Exactly.
Also.
All right. Now this
how
is,
much you weigh, by the way?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just curious.
She's working her way through the front line of the Patriots, actually, this moment.
All right. This is – I don't know why this annoys me. This has annoyed me for my entire life, and it annoys me to this day.
Okay.
Oh, did you get your hair cut? It is so dumb. Why would anybody ask somebody if they got their hair cut? Don't most people get their hair cut like 4 or 5 times? I mean,
that's
every 4 or 5
point.
Weeks. It is so dumb.
You have a great hairdo, you know. Yeah. I've noticed that. I've noticed that on Beat
the
Press.
By the way, I cut it every 4 or 5 weeks.
You raise an interesting question. What is the point of
the
question, by the way? I mean, what is the point?
Did you get your hair cut? I mean, what the
heck? Right. If the answer is yes, so what? And if the answer is no, okay, go ahead.
All right, more.
Yep.
This one is just so dumb. You know, you're down on the Cape or the – how long are you here for? What difference does it make? Are you going to see me tomorrow and the next day? It's like, well, why are you asking how long I'm here for? Am I right?
I don't know if that's quite. I mean, that's
I know
sort
why
of a
they
conversation
ask. I know why they
opener.
Ask. No, because they want to feel better if they're there longer than you and not so.
Now, there's
if,
a lot of passive aggression. I'm going to get to my next one. A lot of that falls into these questions. Here's one of these passive aggression. You're going out to play tennis, and someone says, "Who are you playing with?" Now, this is a very passive aggressive question because they're going to measure their own game by who you're playing with. Oh, you're playing with the chumps, and I'm with the, you know, it's like, oh, okay. It's like one of those questions you just know there's an ulterior motive there.
So do you answer any of these?
Of course not.
No, of course not.
I usually say, I don't know.
Okay, fine.
All right, now these are filler questions I really don't like either. Eaten anywhere good recently? No. It's just a, it's just like one of these filler things. It's like, well, and then, of course, you have to stop and think about it. And, I usually say Shea Rooney. You
know? Shea Rooney. Boy, I asked the governor yesterday.
I was just going to say, who asked the governor yesterday where to eat when she's in Western
Mass
this weekend?
Because I was going to visit one of my kids at her camp, and
classless
he lives up
there. What did he say?
He gave me the three recommendations of restaurants.
I'm surprised he didn't say Shea Patrick, because he's quite the cook.
He didn't say Shea
Patrick.
No,
you know what he said to her, though?
I
wasn't going to say it, but since you brought it, it was off the air. He turns to Marty and says, who are you dating?
So, oh, yeah.
No,
all right, so
joking.
One more filler.
I have long
any good movies lately.
That
falls in that category. And finally, Jim.
Finally.
This is a question that I really hate being asked.
What is it?
Who did you have on your show last night?
The worst.
You know why?
Why?
Because I can't remember.
Watch.
Oh, because you don't remember.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh. No, that isn't.
He would say because you didn't watch. That's why.
That's why I hate that.
No, I'm saying some stranger comes up. Oh, of course, that too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Emily.
Somebody says to me, you know, it's 7 o'clock and you're at some function. And she's, I watch you every night. Apparently not tonight. I always say that.
Hey, Tom from Manchester by the Sea has a very important question.
Oh, he does?
Tom has this question. He wants to know what you think about Market Basket.
Really, does he?
Yeah.
I'm loving this story. I mean, I just can't even believe the passion about it. I mean, I don't know the players well enough to really take a side, but I love the fact that the employees are so passionate about it. So I tend to side with the employees because they obviously care about it so deeply.
I had a guy, like, just quickly... last night, 49 years with this company.
Really?
His 40-year-old son works for the company. His 31-year-old son works for the company. It is like a movie. It's like, what's the Jimmy Stewart movie?
It's a Wonderful Life.
It is like it's a Wonderful Life. Mm. It is, sir. I'm so glad to hear you say that, by the way, that you're on their side.
Yeah.
Okay,
right,
Emily,
is that it?
Beat the Press tonight. Marjorie is one of your panelists,
correct? Yeah, we're going to do Abigail Hernandez.
We are going to talk about Abigail Hernandez.
What
we're going to talk about.
And we're also going to talk about, is it really necessary to that gruesome details of the bodies and the odors and all that stuff. Oh, there's a spine and all that. I mean, do we really need that? Or does it take you to the intensity of the story. So we'll toss
yeah, it's going to a lot of good topics tonight on Beat the Press.
Yep. All right.
Okay.
We'll see you later,
Emily
Marjorie.
Rooney, that was
did you
a
get your haircut, by the way?
Stupendous lead.
Okay.
Who are you dating? I heard
reading?
Rumors.
See you, Emily. Thank you.
Emily Rooney joins us every Friday for Open Mic, and you can keep up with her, of course, weeknights at 7 o'clock on Channel 2, and, of course, tonight on Beat the Press. I'm going to be there, too. I'm very excited. Coming up, it's our Friday news quiz with an unlikely duo, donuts and wine. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You get to hear both sides of the story.
WGBH supporter Emily Kibler from Somerville, Massachusetts.
So I feel like I actually know what's going on in the world. I work in a lab and I spend a lot of time doing rote work. And so I love that it keeps me entertained and keeps me informed all day long.
Show your support at WGBHnews.org.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you. And from aesthetic, reconstructive, and implant dentistry, Newton Wellesley, committed to providing a patient-centered, minimally invasive, and scientific approach to dental care and patients' overall health. More at aridnw.com. And Samets Blackstone Associates, for more than 30 years, helping businesses and nonprofits tell their stories and build relationships through integrated brand strategy, design, and digital media. You can follow them on Twitter at SAMETZ.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3 for our Friday news quiz are, as Marjorie said, an unlikely culinary couple, donuts and wine. Josh Danoff is the co-owner of Union Square Donuts in Union Square, Somerville. Josh, good to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Jonathan Alsop is a regular here. He's the founder of the Boston Wine School, and this is really a preview of things to come. Listen to this. Next Saturday, August 2nd, the taste of Union Square Donuts will be at the Boston Wine School, Jonathan's, for a donuts and wine brunch event. Josh and Jonathan, great to see you both. How are you, gentlemen?
Good, thanks.
Okay, before we find out why you're doing this, because it does sound a little bit unusual, a wine and donut event, I have to say, Jim Brody bought in a bunch of these donuts a month or two ago.
Yeah.
And we were like beside ourselves. We were salivating. When I heard you were coming in again today, I'm on the internet, on the radio last night. I was on the internet last night looking at all these gorgeous donuts with bacon and coconut and the Boston cream. And you have brought us a big box full of donuts. I'm so excited. Oh!
And luckily, I have brought all of those ones that you just mentioned.
Oh, my God.
Where's this
Jim?
Come from, by the way? I don't even know your bag. How'd you get it? It's only like a year old or something, isn't
yeah,
this deal?
Yeah, a year and a bit.
So where did and by the way, these are not donuts. They're called donuts. They're donuts and they're Union Square donuts. They are unbelievable. Where did this concept come from? Are you a baker? Are you a donut guy? What are you?
My business partner, Heather Schmidt, is a baker by trade.
Mm-hmm.
Before Union Square Donuts, we had a business in Somerville called Culinary Cruisers, and we brought kombucha on tap to farmers markets, and we made popsicles, fresh fruit popsicles. And one day, my brother lives in Brooklyn, and he called me up and, you know, because we were always had our eye on what, you know, what could we do next? What's the next product? And he just called up and said, we got to do donuts.
And just out of the blue, he said donuts?
Out of the blue. So as a
had Heather ever done donuts before, so to speak?
No, but she had been working on a dough recipe for about 5 years. And it originated from a brioche dough. So that's what gives the donuts that kind of light and airy, just almost more like a pastry.
Okay, let's open this box one more time.
Yeah.
I can't eat them now because I'm not ready, but they're huge.
Yeah,
these are not your normal size donuts. They're huge and they are spectacular looking. And I'm so glad you brought the bacon ones and the Boston cream pie, and those will have the coconut ones there.
What are these, please? Those are an orange creamsicle.
Ah!
We also have a strawberry and a vanilla bean.
And by the way, for those who are turned off by the concept of bacon on a donut, even if you're a bacon lover as I am, don't complain until you've had it, and you are just going to be incredible. Now, Jonathan, you know I'm a fan of yours. However, a donut and wine pairing? I mean, really,
Jim,
what is that about?
Jim, some men
see wine and donuts and ask why. We see wine and donuts and ask why not.
Why not?
Hey, can I give credit where credit is due?
Yeah,
one
sure.
of our teachers, Beth LeDuc,
yeah.
super talented teacher yeah. at the wine school, she actually cooked this whole thing up.
That's a great
in terms of her idea. And from the wine school perspective, I mean, you know, we're just we're looking for anything that's going to resonate with people to open the door, to get them in, to learn about wine and really start to dig wine. You know, the person who says, you know, hey, come to wine class, maybe that person says, wine class? I don't know. You say, hey, come to donuts and wine class? They say, ooh, where do I sign up?
Has this ever been done? Has there ever been a donut and wine pairing event before this, to your knowledge?
On the planet?
Yeah, on the planet, yeah.
Not that I. Hard to believe that someone sometime had not done this, but this is the first one we've done at the wine school for sure, and we're going to get some on the schedule for the fall, and we may even be, yeah. depending on how this one goes, there may be more opportunities in
Excuse
the pipeline.
Me, wait a second. Sure. Hand me the box while he's talking, okay. will you, Josh? I mean, this is ridiculous.
We should each have a bite.
Yeah, and then Jonathan will tell. We're going to get to the quiz in a second. Jonathan will tell us what to pair with it.
Great. I brought
the box. It's too big.
Okay, I brought two wines, yeah. white wine and a red wine. The white wine is a French blended white.
Of course.
It's from a winery called Vilme. Mm-hmm. It's from Alsace, and it's called Gentil. Gentil means pretty. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really pretty, really attractive blend of white wine. This goes with the vanilla bean, I think.
Okay.
Let's give that a try.
And then I've also got a red wine, it's the 90 plus, a red Bordeaux, a blend of big red grapes to go with the... bacon and
I should hope
I love those the, 90 plus
the bacon
wines.
Maple, yeah.
That's a great concept. Please explain the 90 plus concept if people don't know.
Well, first of all,
please
ninety plus sellers. First of all, there are upstairs neighbor at the wine school, so their world headquarters is directly.
I did not know that
from us,
but I've bought 90 plus many times.
And they are in the wine world, you'd call them an international négociant. This means they buy and sell wine. They buy wine from wineries all over the world, and they label it all under the 90-plus label. So in some ways, it's the best of all possible worlds. You know, they're in the wine business. They're selecting wine. They're selling wine. They're buying wine. They're living the wine life. They own no wineries. They own no vineyards. And in the European wine world, they're called négociants.
Okay, enough storytelling, Jonathan. Wine am I drinking?
Okay, so
am I eating a vanilla bean?
That's a vanilla bean.
Okay,
am I drinking?
Little bite of this vanilla bean. Chew it up, don't swallow it. Sneak a little bit of the white wine, the Vilme Gentil, and kind of let them blend together a little bit. Let them create that third
flavor. This is a very different donut. It's a very, very different donut. The dough is totally different. Yeah. It's great.
How's that work?
Yeah, it's great. Oh, the wine's great with it.
Okay,
here's what we're going to do. We're going to start this quiz, and then after a couple of questions, see how you guys are doing, we will try to pair. What's the red wine again?
The red wine is the 90-plus red Bordeaux.
We're going to pair that with, what is it, the maple bacon, whatever the hell?
Yeah,
what
I
is
can
that
see
thing?
You
whatever.
Rusting for that maple bacon, Jim.
Oh, ma'am. Okay, let's start the quiz. You want to talk to Josh or do you want to do Jonathan?
Okay, I'll start with Josh because he's the donut man. So much as I love the wine man, I'm really excited about the donuts here, too. Okay, you ready, Josh? Who's Seth Meyers talking about here?
Today's traveled to Egypt and had to pass through a metal detector before he could meet with officials, which is ridiculous. Everyone knows he's made of wood.
Okay. Do you have any idea who Seth Meyers is making fun of there?
Big-time diplomat.
John Kerry.
That would be correct.
You are correct. That was great. Off to a great start. Okay, Jim.
It was the made of wood that sort of gave that away. Yes, yeah.
Now, can we just because I really can't stand it anymore, can we try the bacon donut?
Can Jonathan get one question before
please.
We do?
I mean, hedonism first.
I really want to
try the bacon.
You ready? It's unbelievable. Now, this is for you, Jonathan, also. On Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, Fallon gave members of the house band the Roots a pop quiz. He asked them to describe the movie When Harry Met Sally. Here it is.
Isn't that the one where Meg Ryan gets tickled at that diner? And she's like, hee 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 hee. And then the old bat looks over and says, that's what she said. It's the one where Billy Crystal meets Meg Ryan at the top of the Empire State Building. And they get it on.
Tom Hanks and Helen Hunt get stuck on a desert island with a beach ball named William.
Okay, so here's your question, Jonathan. Why were these guys talking about When Harry Met Sally? What was the occasion?
I am going to say the 50th anniversary of the debut of that. Not 50th, the 25th anniversary of
Excellent.
The debut of that film.
Wow.
Very good.
Okay.
I was going to say 50th. My
that was
God.
Very impressive.
You were all watching it in the playpen.
Now, by the way,
I was trying to be calm.
The best scene, of course, and the most famous scene in the movie, when Meg Ryan has the whatever.
Whatever.
Gets tickled.
The best line, maybe, in any comedy movie of at least that era, is when the camera pans to an old lady who happens to be the director's mother, mm-hmm.
Rob Reiner's mother.
Rob
Reiner, who is great.
And she turns to the waitress and she says, "What? I'll have whatever she's having."
Yeah.
It was an ad lib, by the way, too, which is pretty incredible. Okay, it's tied 1-1 at the end of one round.
I love that movie. I can't see that movie enough times.
What do you think of the bacon, maple, whatever?
It's unbelievable. Yeah. I'm coming right over there.
Love the wine.
With all these donuts,
it doesn't matter what
I say.
Somebody ask you a question.
Somebody hit me with some of this. And
oh, yeah, you start with the vanilla bean.
Okay. Can you freeze donuts?
We do not. We recommend that these donuts are eaten the day of.
Eaten the day of, okay. So if I come over and like buy 20, I can't put them in the freezer. I have to eat them
Well, what do you expect the owner of this, co-owner of this thing to say? What is he going to say? Keep them for a couple of months?
They probably do freeze reasonably well, do you think?
People ask how long they last, and I say somewhere between 60 and 90 seconds.
That's a good line, Josh.
Here we go, Josh. Here's a news report from this morning. Have a listen, and we will ask you a question after you hear it.
And this is potentially going to be a huge day for Market. It's been 1 week since the store employees walked off the job, leaving food sitting at the warehouse. Store shelves are empty.
This morning, workers are planning a huge rally outside Market in Tewksbury, Massachusetts, as they continue to demand that former CEO Arthur T. Demoulas be reinstated.
Okay, here's the question. At what company have so many employees walked off the job this week and last?
Market Basket.
Market Basket.
Hey, have you moved into your new place yet?
Not yet. We have started construction there.
But your current place is very close to Market Basket in Somerville. You ever go?
Yes.
And what do you think of Market Basket? Tell the truth. It is great, right?
It's a great place. It's a great spot.
That is correct. Okay, I'm going to have
it's a great spot.
The follow-up question.
You were going to hand me a bacon thing, Josh, if you can.
You want a half or a quarter?
I want a quarter because I'm a little embarrassed for the whole thing.
The texture is very different.
Kind of elasticity.
and the wine.
Yeah,
is
the Bordeaux. How's that
working? I think this is a brilliant concept. Mm. I think you could make zillions of dollars on donut and wine combos. I really think so.
From your mouth to God's
Don't
ear,
Don't you think?
Marjorie.
I think so.
Jonathan, here's your opportunity to tie this baby up. Here's a report out of Los Angeles.
A tree planted to honor of the memory of the Beatles songwriter George Harrison has been killed by The living local monument fell victim to an infestation of that couldn't be overcome if only the had let it be.
This is an incredible and true story. What killed the George Harrison memorial tree in Los Angeles, Jonathan, also?
I'm going to say people carving their initials into it.
That's an excellent guess. That would be wrong.
Is that wrong?
Now, do you have any idea? Think about it for a minute, Josh, before you answer. Even if you don't know, think about the irony of what might have killed the George Harrison Memorial Tree. What would it have been?
I actually had seen the story.
Oh, well, what is it?
I'm going to go with Beatles.
That is exactly correct. An infestation of Beatles with two E's. Okay. Let me try this bacon thing. Hold on a second.
Jim.
Can you talk while I'm eating?
I was going to say Linda Asher, but that's probably not right.
Okay, Josh, here's your question. Here's an ESPN reporter.
Can I say, oh, my God, first?
Oh, my God.
It was really – you know what's great, by the way? For those who've never been to our studio, our producers, our colleagues are in another room. They're in a room that is donut-free.
They have to wait.
And we're in a room that is loaded with donuts and wine.
And you know what's really exciting?
They're visibly drooling.
We've tried the vanilla bean. We've tried the bacon. Mm-hmm. We have yet to try the banana cream pie or the coconut. Is that coconut over there?
Yep, toasted coconut.
Or the strawberry or the orange.
What's that chocolate thing in the corner?
This is
banana cream pie.
Boston cream.
Boston cream. Oh, sorry, Boston cream.
I'm excited about the creamsicle.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, the creamsicle.
The orange creamsicles.
Oh, boy, Jim, this is a great day.
Next, Archer.
Here's an ESPN reporter having some trouble recalling a famous line.
That's one small step for mankind, one giant leap for mankind.
Okay. Why was this reporter trying, and she tried, to quote Neil Armstrong?
Is it the anniversary of the moonwalk?
It is the anniversary.
Did they get credit
Do you know
for that
which anniversary it is?
He gets a half a point for that, judges.
If you know which year. You know what anniversary it is?
I do not.
Do you know Jonathan Alsop? You can steal a half a point.
Let's see. I'm going to say 69 to, I'm going to say 35.
Well, even though you're 45? Wrong in terms of 35, you're right with the year, so we're going to give him
75?
A half point. It was 1969.
Is this a math question?
It is, you know, a math question. Thing? 69 is the right year, isn't it?
Yeah, it
but
is.
But you're off. 69 and 45 is 2014.
Can I share a little anecdote here?
Certainly.
Last night I'm watching CNN's series, The 60s, and it, coincidentally the series is about the our travels into space, the back and forth with Russia, with Sputnik, etc. I didn't know until last night that Walter Cronkite, arguably one of the great news people of all time, was a huge spaceophile. Mm. And so one of the images is Walter Cronkite in an in a weightless thing with astronauts trying out and, you know, doing their weightless thing. And Walter Cronkite is very buttoned up, literally and figuratively, except for the fact his hair is standing straight up on top of his head.
And it's wearing his little bow tie.
Excuse me. I want to introduce Josh because I got an email from Art wanting to know where he can get.
Oh, of course, we haven't said we're in Union Square.
Delicious maple bacon donuts and everything else. It is at Union Square Donuts in Somerville. And Jonathan Alsop is from the Boston Wine School, which is over on, do we call it Commonwealth Avenue?
Yeah, Con Ave in Alston.
Yeah, Con Ave in Alston.
Yeah, bostonwineschool.com. And Josh, where do people get tickets for Saturday?
So you can either go to our website or you can go to donuts-wine-pairing.eventbrite.com.
What's your website?
UnionSquareDonuts.com. Yeah.
You know, how long you over? You know, I have to say,
do
the
you
only
have parking,
complaint.
Parking there? I'm sorry.
It's decent parking. I go there in that neighborhood a lot. Let me just say, the only complaint I have about your stuff, because they're as good as I've ever, I mean, they're really great, is in the old days, I don't know if it's still the case, you get to your place like 6 minutes after it's open. You weren't in line all night for the donuts, and they're sold out. I mean, you're dealing with the whole volume issue?
So we are making more donuts. So, in the space that we currently have, we've been sharing the space. So we've been there for we have limited hours that we were there and limited equipment and limited production space. We're currently, we've started construction on a new shop. We're currently at 16 Bow Street and we're going to be moving to 20 Bow Street. So
And that's going to deal with a capacity issue? You're going to be producing a lot more donuts.
So our production space, the kitchen's going to be about twice as big.
Great.
Everything is going to be set up for making donuts.
Okay, Jonathan, you're behind, but here's your opportunity to get a little closer.
All right.
What 20-foot-tall curiosities were the talk of the five boroughs this week, and where did they appear?
The appearance of the 20-foot-tall is a major embarrassment for the New York City Police Department. John Miller is the Deputy Commissioner for Intelligence and Counterterrorism.
Video shows us a number of people crossing the bridge. The light that normally illuminates first flickers and then appears to go out.
Carefully fitted aluminum covers were used to kill the lights. The were not spotted until this morning.
This is a very hard one if you don't know the story. So the question is, what 20-foot-tall curiosities were the talk of the five boroughs, obviously New York City, this week, and where did they appear? Do you have any idea what this
is? Appear? Well, first of all, I don't.
Okay.
I'm trying to think what would possibly appall a New Yorker?
That's a very good point. Give him really a half point for that. Thank
you. Can I just guess?
Sure. Why
not? Like 20-foot reproductions of the Twin Towers or
that's a good guess. That's a good guess.
Do you have any idea? Did you hear this?
That was going to be my guess too.
It is two white flags which replace the two American flags which normally are at the top of the Brooklyn Bridge. That's really odd, is it not?
Did we ever get to the bottom of that?
What?
That
flag
story
thing?
About who did it and why?
The flag thing?
Yes.
I never even heard of the story.
I heard of the story. Really? I just didn't know what the answer was. If someone was mad at us about,
maybe they want some donuts.
You know what the other big question I think that people
want
to get to the bottom of, Marjorie, is whether or not that red wine goes with the maple. Let me try it right now.
Okay, you try it right now.
Someone move like some of that maple bacon donut down this direction.
Yeah, we need some. Jonathan needs some maple bacon.
Let's get this going counterclockwise.
Yeah, just do a quarter though, because we have four hungry producers and an engineer in here.
Let them get their own donuts. Okay, now we're going to the bonus round. What's the score, judges, if you would please?
Here we go.
3.5 for Josh, the co-owner of Union Square Donuts, and 2 for Jonathan Alsop from the Boston Wine School. Since donuts and wine are an unlikely duo, you know, we agree, we're going to ask you about Neil Simon's play-turned-movie-turned-TV show The Odd Couple. You ask the first question. Ask it of Jonathan Olsop.
Okay,
please.
I'm going to say what I always say. These are hard, so don't get upset if you don't get them wrong. If you don't get them right, because everybody gets them wrong. Since donuts and wine, Jonathan, are an unlikely duo, we're going to ask you. Oh, Jim just read that.
I did. Okay.
There have been many theatrical revivals of The Odd Couple. Who starred in one of these productions as Oscar and Felix? A. John Goodman and Kelsey Grammer. B. Sally Struthers and Rita Moreno. Or C. Chuck Barris and Regis Philbin.
Chuck Barris and Regis Philbin?
What's the answer?
I'm going to say, you know what? I'm going with Chuck Barris and Regis Philbin.
That's wrong. It's okay. Do you have any idea in who starred in one of these theatrical revivals of The Odd Couple as Oscar and Felix, Josh?
I think I want it to be B, but yeah. I'm going with B.
Go with B.
No.
Go
really?
With B. Good move.
That was very Sally nice. Struthers, Rita Moreno in drag or what?
I don't know. But by the way, I saw Rita Moreno, who people don't maybe forget. She starred as Rita in West Side Story, one of the classic. And she had many of the roles after that. That's probably her most famous. I saw her at 80-something speaking over in Dorchester someplace in some women's event. Unbelievable.
You meant as Maria. She just starred as Maria, right?
No, she started.
Oh, as Rita?
Rita.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No, Natalie Wood was Maria,
the feisty,
Jim.
The feisty.
Oh, you mean in the
original? The feisty
ages
girlfriend.
Ago. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Ages ago, that's right.
Here you go, Josh. You can expand your expanding lead. Which of the following is true? A, Mel Brooks and the mild insanity brought on by his low blood sugar inspired the character Felix Unger. B, Dick Van Dyke and the particular way he creased his pants inspired the character of Felix Unger. Or C. Sid Caesar and his frequent outbursts about litter bugs inspired the character of Felix Unger. Which of the three is it?
I'm going to go with B.
Wow. He is right
that
yet
is
again.
That's very good.
Now, what's the score, judges, at the end of with one question left, please? Oh, that's not the right answer.
Oh,
the judges
the right
made
answer.
A mistake. It was an excellent guess, but you're wrong. Okay, so is it A or C, Jonathan Alsop?
Okay, so A was...
Mel Brooks, inspired or Sid Caesar inspired? Which is
Mel
it?
Mel Brooks or Sid Caesar? Sid Caesar.
Which was it, judges?
Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks. I was exactly. going to say Mel Brooks. Now, here's the deal. How many points behind is Jonathan? Can he even see the leader at this point or not? Whatever. 4.5 to 2.
Just ask me a 10-point question.
Okay, this is it's a 2.5 point. It's a 2.5 point question. You either tie or you go home wineless. Here it is. This clip is from the movie The Odd Couple, starring Jack Lemmon as Felix and Walter Matthau as Oscar. Oh, am I supposed to be asking this? You're supposed to be. Well, whatever it is.
Go ahead.
What is Felix doing in this scene? Here's the clip. Okay. You want to read the answers, Marjorie?
Oh, the answers. A, foretelling the famous fake orgasm in When Harry Met Sally. B, having a panic attack because the waitress put his salad fork on the wrong side of the plate. Or C, cleaning his sinuses.
Is this my question?
Yes,
yes it is.
Yes,
you can tie things up here.
The sinuses.
You
yes.
are right.
Ooh,
cleaning
great
his
confidence.
Sinuses. That's very good.
Yeah.
So we have a tie.
We do have a tie. Now, gentlemen, tell us before you go. This is Josh Danoff, as you know, is the co-owner of Union Square Donuts, which you've got to check out. You've particularly got to check it out now because he is pairing his operation and Jonathan Olsop from the Boston Wine School. Tell us one more time, Jonathan, starting with you. Saturday, August 2nd. What's the deal, please?
Yeah, Saturday, August 2nd, 12 to 2. It's a holistic wine tasting, wine and donuts. Six wines, am I right? Six wines, six different donuts.
Yep.
We're going to be putting them together, taught by Boston Wine School teacher Beth LeDuc.
And how many? What are the donuts that are going to be available on that particular day? The six that you have here?
Yeah, the six that we have here.
What are they again?
The Boston cream,
yes.
The maple bacon,
yeah.
Vanilla bean, strawberry, orange creamsicle, and toasted coconut.
What's your most popular donut? It's got to be the bacon thing.
Yeah, the maple bacon is hands down the most popular.
And did you think when you put this thing together, or your Heather, your partner, whatever, did you think the bacon combo, even though everybody is bacon obsessed, was actually going to work, or were you a little nervous about it?
Well, my feeling was it had to be because it combined. It's all three food groups. It has maple, bacon, and donut. So how could it not work?
You ever tried bacon toothpaste?
I have not.
I have. It is unbelievable. I'm telling you, it is really, really.
I think you
really
can't
good.
Go wrong with bacon.
I mean, if bacon doesn't work, what? I mean, just
exactly.
go home.
Why bother living?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's right.
And it was great. Beth came over to the shop the other night, and Beth has a company called Wine for All, and we filled up a table with wine, and we had the whole pairing, and we just went through all the donuts and all the wine and really figured out, you know, started to figure out some of the great wines that went with other donuts.
Yeah, and so this is August 2nd.
August 2nd. Yeah, August 2nd. Really,
and how do they find out about it again? You going to tell them? Or?
Well, I'm going to tell them that Josh Danoff is the co-owner of Union Square Donuts, Jonathan Alsop, founder of Boston Wine School. The Donuts and Wine Brunch is next Saturday, August 2nd. And there's a website, real quick. What is it?
Yeah, unionsquaredonuts.com.
Unionsquaredonuts.com. Okay, thank you both for coming in.
Thanks,
is really
guys.
Fun.
Great. Right.
And thank you
thank
all for
you.
Listening to Boston Public Radio. Tune in Monday for All Revved Up with our political roundtable. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our team, Chelsea Murr, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan. Our engineer is John Parker, and our intern is Devin Karambulis. And I wanted to wish you, Jim, you know, kind of, it's nice for your birthday. They probably didn't know it was your birthday, bringing the donuts.
It's not my birthday. It's Amanda McGowan's birthday.
It's Amanda's.
Our colleague. Happy birthday, Amanda. Have a donut
Amanda
on us.
Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in, and please tune in again on Monday. Have a great weekend.